Now entering Nerdist.com.
Chew It
with a guy named Kevin.
Chew It
and this other guy Steve.
Chew It
from the TV and the movies and now this podcast stream.
Chew It,
they're gonna get chewy.
Chew It,
they might even get me.
Chew It,
but they're gonna get funky on this podcast thing.
Hi everyone, this is Steve Lemmy. And on behalf of Kevin Heffernan, I'd like to welcome you all to another episode of Chewing It with Kevin and Steve. I was just imagining chewing a slice of New York pizza. And the reason for that is because we have a very, 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 very special guest that we had travel all the way to New York City to get. I'm not going to tell you why this guest is so special, because you're going to hear it when we introduce him in the actual podcast. And y'all don't need to be doubling up on all this information. So before I do get into any of that podcast business, let me just do our weekly plugs, okay? We've got some Midwest tour dates and some Pacific Northwest tour dates. So June 19th, Kansas City. We're going to be in Kansas City, Missouri at the Riot Room. June 20th, Milwaukee, Wisconsin at the Miramar Theater. June 21st, Chicago, Illinois at Abbey Pub. June 22nd, Des Moines, Iowa, Woolies. June 23rd in Minneapolis, Minnesota at Mill City Nights. So that's it for that little stretch. Come on out, Midwest. We can't wait to see you. Now we go to Pacific Northwest in July. July 18th, San Francisco at Cobb's. July 19th, Portland, Oregon at the Hawthorne Theater. And July 20th, Seattle, Washington at Sunset Tavern. Then July 21st, 22nd, and 23rd, we are going to be in Vancouver, and those specific venues will be announced very shortly. For all this information, up-to-date, up-to-the-moment information, you can find us on our website, www.heffernanlemmy.com. Also, our Facebook page, Heffernan Lemmy. Our Twitter accounts, I'm at Steve Lemmy, Kevin is at Heffernan Rules. Heffernan Rules. What a dumb Twitter handle. Instagram, we're at Heffernan Lemmy, where we are slowly but surely building up a stockpile of hilarious photos. For those of you who are asking about Fatty and Tatty, still stuck in just a little bit of legal stuff, and we're going to figure that out really soon. You are going to see it. You are going to see it. Okay. So, with no further ado, our guest this week is screenwriter Andy Bellin. He hails from New York City. He is the screenwriter of the upcoming biopic Lovelace about Linda Lovelace. And he has a lot of other projects in the can, and he's a very special guy to me, and you're going to hear about it. So here we go. Everyone, a new episode of Chewing It.
Okay. Hi, everybody. Welcome to this week's edition of Chewing It with Kevin and Steve. This is Steve Lemmy.
I'm Kevin Heffernan.
And we have a special guest here today. So, by the way, this podcast is called Chewing It.
Yeah. You knew that, though, right?
I did.
You
totally
knew that.
I listened to a podcast.
Okay.
Like one of our podcasts or a podcast in the world?
A podcast.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, but our podcast.
It was Steve Carell.
It
was very funny.
That makes sense.
What's his called? It's not Chewing It, is it?
Yeah, it's Chewing It with Steve Carell.
Christmas Carells.
Nice.
I don't know what I would name mine if I was Steve Carell.
Okay, so
you were handling my microphone.
I was.
Don't touch my microphone.
I put a little green microphone closer
Damn
to his
you.
Mouth.
Uh-huh.
We chew it. It's called Chewing It. We like to chew it from time to time during the podcast.
What does that mean? Exactly?
You just do this.
Obviously. Do I have to do it? Also?
And now
yeah,
want,
you do. Yeah,
yeah.
As a guest,
yeah.
You have to. Oh yeah.
Yeah. Okay. But not the.
You don't have to. Some people do. A lot of people.
How
moan.
Do you chew?
But this sounds to me like I'm jerking off.
Okay.
That's what people have said, too.
It's fair.
So
it's fair.
Now I'm just boring because other people have said
no,
this,
no, no.
Too.
But, I mean, I think it's accurate.
Universally.
What you're saying is accurate.
Okay. Do you chew like a normal person with those false teeth of yours?
We're going right there immediately. They're not false teeth.
They're not falsies?
No.
They're
pseudo teeth. Most of them are caps or crowns, we like to say, in the dentistry business.
How about the ones that got knocked out when we were 10 years old?
Only one of them got knocked out.
It wasn't two?
No, that's like a half a tooth. You know, it's like a gold post now because there is a tooth left there. But there's
it's
only
like a vampire
one,
tooth.
I only have two missing teeth, but I have 11 fake teeth.
Okay.
Wrap your melon around
it's
that.
It's got to be a record.
That's
a record.
11 fake teeth. Why do you have 11 fake teeth?
Because I had a couple knocked out, and I was just, you know, I just have bad teeth.
You got bad teeth. What are you going to do?
Okay. Yeah. No, look, I come from a family of bad teeth people. Argentina.
Tell me about it.
My dad, you know, gnawed on sugar cane his whole life. He's right. got no real teeth left.
And an uncircumcised penis. That's
and he has an uncircumcised penis. Here we go. Here we go.
Well, I mean, you know, we went
gnawed on that.
Okay, so let me introduce you then and, and explain why we're going at each other so hard.
Okay.
People, today we have an accomplished screenwriter. He has written some
films. Did you have to like check the notes for what I've done?
Well, I wanted to see if I was going to introduce you by name now or if I was going to wait till the end. I'm going to wait till the end.
Okay.
You have written a couple of movies that have been made now. You wrote a movie.
Big one coming out.
Yes,
big one coming out.
August 9th in theaters.
August 9th. Okay. Yes.
We're going to get there.
Good. Good.
Okay. We have you wrote a movie called Trust with Clive Owen.
And Catherine Keener.
And Catherine Keener.
And Viola Davis, directed by David Schwimmer.
Yes. We should talk about that too.
Okay. We just did.
We're Gonna More.
Yeah, okay. We're Gonna More. Came out on a Lifetime recently.
Yeah, it was a Lifetime movie. And I'd like to say 2.5 stars.
Oh, yeah.
And that's right in the Super Troopers.
Right there.
That's what you're saying. Like, I think we've only ever gotten 2.5 stars.
Yes. 35% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Yes. Well, see, now we're in the 80s in Rotten Tomatoes.
Oh, you are?
Yeah.
Well, it's critically acclaimed. I mean, you tackled a difficult issue.
You still haven't said his name yet. I have a little pet peeve when you start talking too much and you can't say the guy's name. Say the guy's name.
This is Andy Bellin.
Yay.
Yes.
I would like to say Andrea Della Croce. Spalding Bellin.
There you go. Except it's Andre, but whatever.
Well, it's funny because on your birth certificate, it's spelled Andrea. So.
No, it's really not.
Yeah, it actually is because I've seen it.
Okay.
Because I've seen it. Okay. Andy also wrote a script for the movie Lovelace.
Yes, with Amanda Seyfried, Sharon Stone.
That's
James
the big
Franco,
movie.
The big movie coming out August 9th, theaters everywhere.
Man, that's it.
I'm distributed by Harvey Weinstein.
I'm excited.
Everybody.
I'm excited to talk about that movie.
I can show you pictures that'll get you really excited.
Oh, it was funny because I tried to show one of those pictures to Bill Paxton, and you know Amanda played his daughter in Big Love.
Amanda Seyfried, it may be the best person in human history to promote this movie because she is just so cool. Am I allowed to curse?
And gorgeous.
Yeah, you can curse.
She's so fucking great.
And she's gorgeous.
Gorgeous and hot and cool and just everything that you ever wanted in a person to promote this movie. She's just epic. And Peter Sarsgaard, who plays her husband, is so sick. He is just, it's the performance of his lifetime. So.
We went to the same high school.
Yeah, he doesn't know who you are, though.
I know that.
No.
But he's not a Broken Lizard fan?
He's never seen Super Troopers or Bear Fest?
He probably has. I mean, you want to text him right now and find out?
Yeah, text him.
And then find out if he knows I went to the same high school as him.
Yeah.
Sarsgaard. Yeah.
And then ask him if he wants to be in Super Troopers too. And whatever he says, just text him immediately and say, just kidding, they don't want you.
Oh, yeah.
Really?
No, I do. I do.
He's like one of the greatest actors. Yeah.
No, I do.
I think I love that guy.
Yeah.
And he's a cool guy too.
Okay.
Yeah, he was great in Boys Don't Cry. Creepy.
And that, Green Lantern.
Wait. Lantern, you went there?
I like Green Lantern.
He loves it. He loves it. And we're going to talk more about Lovelace.
Okay, sure.
Okay. Aside from the screen rating, you are also an accomplished poker player.
That's correct.
You have written a book on poker.
And what's the name of it?
It's called Poker Nation.
Oh, man.
And
it was a bestseller in 2002.
We'll talk about that, too.
Oh, so, but I have to stop now?
Yeah, no, just kind of tease it, and then we'll come back to it. Poker Nation.
Poker Nation by Andy Bell.
By Andy Bell.
HarperCollins presents.
You also played in the World Series of Poker.
Many times.
Get out of here.
How many times have you played?
Probably 7, but, you know, before it was the ridiculous.
Enough.
Just tease it.
No, tease it.
We'll come back to that. I have all kinds of questions.
It's like a surveys class.
Well, what it is, here's the problem.
Let's do the French Revolution. Right. Okay, she's dead. Now let's move on.
Perfect. No, Kevin, see, we actually have a problem. Kevin and I like to give the resume, but then we keep stopping to talk, and we wind up like talking about one thing for the first 30 minutes, and then we start rushing through everything.
How the fuck long is this thing going to be?
Oh, that's what Paxton said.
It's just starting, bro.
Oh, great.
I hope you put some money in the meter.
Right.
Okay. So poker.
No, it's also my law background, I feel like. I need to be in an orderly fashion.
What law background?
I went to law school.
No, you didn't.
I did.
Dude, he passed the bar. We talked about this every week on our podcast. You should listen. He passed the bar in 2 states.
I did. Carell didn't mention it.
Carell.
He doesn't know him?
No.
That's
Carell
crazy.
Has not seen our movies?
Did you go to high school with him?
No. I'm sure he's a fan of Super Troopers.
Yeah.
He definitely is.
Carell.
Okay, so aside from the screenwriting and the poker, this person is also the biggest prick I've ever met.
Yes.
Okay. Bigger than me?
bigger than you.
Bellin's a bigger prick than I am?
Well, he's the OP. He's the original prick.
Okay. Yeah, since, you know, coming to you since 1982.
True. Well, I've been a prick all my life, too, so it's okay.
Yeah, but he's known me longer.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, he's like a rich prick.
Okay. And I'm a poor prick?
You're like a you're a blue-collar
prick.
Prick.
Okay.
And Andy's, you know.
A rich prick, apparently.
Yeah. Okay, and he also happens to be my best friend from growing up.
There you go.
In New York City.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Bellin.
The dirt we can get.
Andy Bellin, everybody.
Andre.
How many times have I caught him masturbating? Just on one hand?
I don't know. How many?
Just one hand
alone.
You
actually never have.
Right.
And I only masturbate on one hand alone. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. You've only caught me masturbating 0 times.
Well, you were about to masturbate last time I caught
that
you masturbating.
Doesn't count.
Right, because I started laughing.
Exactly.
Okay.
Well, here's the thing about this.
No, let's move on. Go on.
Yeah, about masturbation. Yeah, yeah.
By the way, we're into the podcast, and I'm the quarterback.
Okay, I see.
Okay, and I tell it to every guest who gets mouthy with me.
Okay, me and Paxson better shut up.
Yeah, well, it's just like...
You told Paxson, too. He did.
Yeah, like I direct the pace of it.
Got it, sure. Got it. Sure.
Here's the thing. So Andy grew up in a house, and they had a long balcony that spanned a few different rooms.
Okay. In rich person parlance, it's called a terrace.
A long balcony. I see, as opposed to a balcony.
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
Got it.
Yeah. And and so...
What about a veranda? Do they call that, too?
Yeah.
Can they call it a veranda?
As where Steve's from, a ledge. You know, a very long, wide ledge.
Right. Yeah. Where pigeon shit.
Yeah. That's the fire escape is what we call it, where I'm from.
All right.
But I claimed that I was going to go to the bathroom.
Yeah.
And I went into the bathroom that was off this... terrace.
Yes.
Okay.
I was far away from Andy's room.
Okay.
You know, and I don't know what... I can't remember what I was doing.
I don't know what came over.
What do you mean you can't remember what you were doing?
I can't remember what... I sat down on the toilet.
Okay.
And I was, you know, I was preparing to do a few things, but all of a sudden I heard this laughter coming from someplace.
Okay.
And I looked over towards the window.
Yeah.
And Aunt Bellin was out there watching me.
This was 2 years ago, by the way.
Okay. Yeah. Was it?
But I told him I was going to take a poop.
And were you?
No.
Okay. And so what were you doing when he was laughing at you?
I was sitting on the can.
No, you were not. You were combing your hair, you freak.
You were combing your hair?
He wants to look good for himself as he's jerking off.
Maybe he wanted to look good for you.
No, he was looking in a mirror, combing his hair, going for it.
Shit, well, really? Did you keep a comb in your back pocket at that time?
I did. Okay. This was like, I was 13 or something when this happened. Or 14?
No. No, because we moved it. Yeah, it was 13.
I had long hair parted down the middle.
Yes, you did.
And I had a technique, which is I'd take the comb, I'd go once on the right side all the way back.
Okay.
I'd go once on the left side all the way back. And then I'd...
Both hands.
Two hands on the comb now, comb parallel to the floor. I would take it from the middle, front middle, and pull it all the way back. And then I would like arrange my bangs.
He would feather it down.
Okay.
Just so.
Yeah.
All right.
Sweet hair part. So I did that.
And that's what he was laughing at.
Well, I was there to scare him, but it just kept getting better and better and better.
Oh, see, I thought it was, you caught him masturbating.
Well,
he was
essentially jerking his hair off.
I don't know what you're actually not. You're missing out on the crucial detail. Was that then? I did reach slowly down into my pants.
Yes.
And that's when Andy started.
That's when
laughing.
I started laughing.
Okay, as like a warning, like I'm here, or I mean, didn't you really see where it went?
Oh no, I wanted to see where I was going to go, but I could not control it. Okay. It was too funny. I mean, how often do you get to see a guy feather comb his hair and then jerk off
to himself in the mirror?
Honestly, it's only a couple of times.
I tell you, there's only a couple of people. And I think Lemmy would be a prime candidate if I had to guess who would do that kind of thing.
Sure.
Know? Hey, I'm horny, and I like to look good.
Speaking of jerking off and horny.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk about Lovelace.
Yes, yes.
We're gonna get to our background, but we want to talk...
But let's plug this movie. I have like all kinds of questions about this movie. I'm psyched to see it. I'm interested in it.
Yes.
Let's talk about
it. I have one important question about this movie.
Okay. You do see her naked.
Tell us how they did the blowjobs.
I'm going to say that I'm actually not going to talk about that because it is so perfectly shot and it is so perfectly acted out and it is such a fantastic scene. That it's. I'm just.
Well, no, you have to tease him a little bit.
Where's your comb?
Get a little foreplay going on a bell. Go back. Like, how did you get that job? Was it an open writing assignment? Did you?
It was.
Pitch it?
It was an open writing assignment.
Okay.
My agents sent me out for it, and there were a couple other writers, and I had a very good take.
So you go into the room and they say, "What's your take on this?" Because there were a couple of different ones floating around, like a couple of different projects
there
about Linda Lovelace floating around.
This project originated, you know, there have been people trying to make this movie since 1995, and there was another project that had Lindsay Lohan attached that was also a very good script that I actually never read until after the movie. But it's a very difficult story to tell because Linda's life was very fragmented.
Yeah,
am I allowed to like? speak?
You can, yeah, you can speak.
Yes. Use full sentences and
please
stuff.
Do.
You've got the green light.
Okay. Now we are into the filmic portion of
right,
our discussion.
Right, this is the erudition and stuff.
Now, this is the stuff where people really want to listen to, not that other stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
So that
her life was fragmented.
It was fragmented. Yeah. She was really a Catholic high school girl.
Yeah.
Then she became the first international superstar of pornography.
Yeah.
Then she came out a couple of years later and said that what you were watching was me as a victim, that my
right.
husband was holding me captive, that I was abused, that you're watching me get raped when you're watching Deep Throat.
Yeah.
So she was a victim. And then years later, in sort of recovery, she decided that she was going to end up as an activist for the women's rights movement and ended up being co-opted by the women of, against pornography
right,
and
help
Gloria Steinem and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
So she lived these really full existences. And the difficulty for us was how to tell the full story.
Right.
And also how to do justice to the fact that when she came out and said, hey, I was abused and you're watching me get raped, a lot of people were like, actually, I was on set and you seem pretty happy and you could have run away anytime you wanted.
Yeah. That was the interesting thing about, like, I kind of read a little better or I have in the past, and it sounded like no one knows what the true story is, which from a screenwriter's perspective, whose, you know, point of view do you take? You know what I mean? And like, was she a victim? Was she not a victim? How do you decide to do that?
Well,
you know?
Look, I mean, my personal feelings was that she was mostly a victim, but she, you know, she was flown to Paris first class and she slept with a number of very famous people and seemed to be very happy about it. So there were times that she was sort of enjoying the process, but most of the time she was a captive and a victim and terrified.
Because there were these stories about her, like her husband holding a gun to her head,
true
why
story.
She performed these things.
True story.
And, you know,
I think in his words, too. Has he admitted stuff like that?
No, because there was a lawsuit, and he's dead, but you know, he never fully apologized. And he was a really incredible sort of story, because the story really isn't Linda in a sense, because she's just a Catholic high school girl who was very pretty and very sweet and very naive and met the wrong guy. What was amazing about Chuck was that right after Linda, he then met Marilyn Chambers and turned her into the second most famous porn star of that era. So he was like this porn Svengali.
Right.
And
he married her.
Married her and turned her into a porn star. And she was a legitimate model. She was the Ivory Soap Girl, 99.9% pure. So he had this power over women that was really scary.
Yeah.
So, and Sarsgaard is so good at it. It's
played by Peter Sarsgaard, and
he's so unbelievable that it's just his best role ever.
So, like, what was your take when you went in?
What we wanted to do,
and let me just, like, so people who are listening, when writers, when there's a project going on out there, studios or whoever's financing the film will bring in a number of different writers to give a pitch, basically, about how they would tell a story, what they think is interesting about the story.
And what I did was that I thought it was important to pay respect to each individual section of her life. And we did that by showing a number of the same scenes over again, but from different perspectives. So that we showed it from Linda the porn star, and then later on we showed it from Linda the victim, and then finally as Linda the sort of evangelist, somebody who has actually conquered her fears and moved on.
Right.
So it's really clever. The directors are Rob Epstein and Jeffrey Friedman, who won Oscars for the documentary of Harvey Milk.
Oh.
And these guys are just so talented, and they ended up sort of taking my ideas and mixing them with theirs, and it just turned out unbelievable.
That's awesome. But just to go back, so you go in the room, you sell your take.
Yeah.
They hire you as the writer.
Yes.
And then you have a writing partner or no?
No.
You did it on your own?
Yes.
And so you go off and do you do research? Had you done research? Like, do you watch her movies? Do you read her biographies? What do you do? How do you?
I was familiar with the source material.
Okay, sure. Sure.
Well, we had actually, when we were kids, I remember somehow
from my father, from my pervert father.
Yeah.
What do you mean your dad had all those movies?
Yeah, and some homemade ones, too.
Andy's dad was like, he was our main educator. Like, he, you know, let's be honest, he taught me how to roll a joint.
Right. This is what weed tastes like.
Yeah.
You know?
Andy and I had a scam that we wanted to sell oregano joints to, like, freshmen.
Yeah, we were classy.
And did you do that?
We did, but we first needed to learn how to roll a joint.
Oh, okay.
I think we were actually in, like, eighth grade.
Yeah, because
and so who taught whom?
My dad taught us how to roll a joint.
Oh, so your dad? Okay,
yeah, my dad can roll awesome joints.
Okay,
yeah.
It's that Amherst education.
And so he was a part of your scam then, or
well,
did he not
unwittingly?
Know that?
And okay. I think the statute of limitations is over.
We're okay.
Yeah,
we're okay. But okay, so he had a copy of Deep Throat.
Yeah, so I'd seen Deep Throat a number of times. And
by the way, Deep Throat, the movie, is actually a great plot.
Yes, it is, but it's an awful porn.
Fair enough, but this is like, you know, as far as your porn conceits go.
But also we're talking about 1970, what, two? 74?
1971 was the shooting. And if you're not familiar with the story, you know, most pornographic films of that time were basically 8-minute, what they called loops. So it was just two people fucking and you know, black and white, and there was
and
no
you have
story
to go to the theater, and you have to sit in the theater and watch it in the theater.
And with a bunch of people who were jacking
and it was
off.
It was designed to have people jerk off and walk away. And these wonderful guys, Butchie Pereno and Jerry Damiano, came up with the idea that they wanted to make a film, and I swear to God, this was the pitch. They were going to make a film that after you jerked off, you stayed to see the end. That was the pitch.
That's their take on
that's
the
their take. Yeah. So they ended up writing a story that Jerry wrote a 44 fucking page script, as he liked to describe it, about a woman who enjoyed sex but didn't enjoy it in the way she knew everybody else was enjoying it, went to see a doctor, and the doctor said, aha, I've discovered your problem.
Right.
Problem is your clitoris is in the back of your throat.
Right.
So, 9 inches, 13 inches? There was like a specific, I remember when we watched it together side by side, there was a...
Yeah, it was nine inches deep is the Sword Swallower is the movie was originally titled.
Right.
And she and the Harry Reams, who was the male lead, who sadly just passed away about a week ago or maybe a month ago,
and also has his a very interesting story.
Yeah, he was a nice guy. I mean, he was arrested for indecency, and he was sort of the Supreme Court case that. That allowed for distribution of pornographic material.
I mean, didn't he essentially become the target or the?
Yeah, he was arrested. He was arrested for I think it was interstate commerce or something very complicated. It ended up going to the Supreme Court saying that this was a violation of indecency, and then he was able to, you know, we were able to make pornography. So, Linda then joyfully gives him head and gets off, and it's the bombs going off,
and she discovers her
fireworks
purpose in life.
Yeah, and Linda, Chuck had taught her a technique that he had learned. Chuck had been in the, in the army, and he was stationed in Korea. And he had picked up, as he used to like to say, he picked up a technique in the Orient. Mm-hmm. And these women would do exactly what he said. And it was a technique of deep throating while giving head. And and as Amanda has described in many an interview, it's like trying to sing, you know, it's opening your throat. Amanda says this. She is that awesome.
For us, it's like you try to chug beer.
Right. Or your case, a lollipop.
That's correct.
What?
Yeah, popsicle.
But you can you open your throat, Kev?
Somewhat to chug a beer a little bit. Not,
I mean, we know
there.
People. We know.
Yeah, we know
people
guys who
can.
But you know, some people have that skill. I don't have a clitoris in the back of my throat.
How do you know?
Are you sure?
How do you know?
Steve,
because I've eaten some fucking hot dogs, bro. I've had some.
So you
sausage.
Swallow hot dogs?
Yeah, whole. I don't chew them.
A foot long. His clitoris is 20 feet down his belly.
It's in my stomach, my clitoris.
You have an orgasm every time you eat a good meal.
I do. That's why I chew and moan.
Mm-hmm. Let's chew it. Chew it.
Mm-hmm. Me again?
Yeah. Go ahead. So back to the research of it. So now...
I was pretty familiar with pornography in general because I was a fan of the medium. And Deep Throat is an interesting idea. I was very happy that it sort of broke barriers in the sense that it was a wonderful First Amendment tool.
Yeah.
The problem was that Linda was abused. She was paid $1,250 for a movie that putatively grossed, I think, $660 million, which I don't believe, but, you know, stories of mob money laundered and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And, of course, the sad part is even for the $1,250, Chuck stole every penny of it, and Linda never saw a cent. So... that was sort of an awful part, but the story was wonderful. But if you go back, I'm pretty familiar with modern day porn, and there are a lot of really great looking people with very little hair. Right. Deep Throat was very hairy,
very hairy,
and not so great looking people.
Yeah.
But
that's not the case in the movie because Amanda.
Amanda's pretty hot.
Right. None of the principals are alive anymore, or were alive when you were writing the movie, right?
It is so strange, but everybody died during the movie.
Oh, okay. There was a car accident.
Linda's dad was alive. He died.
Okay.
The two reporters who did the original interviews and co-wrote books with her, they died during it. Everybody died.
Were you able to talk to any of these people before they died, or was
no,
it, or
I
did
got,
you?
I,
or?
Got, I got source material. I got interviews of theirs and stuff like that. We were lucky enough. Linda has a lawyer named Catherine McKinnon who represented her throughout life, and also is this legendary feminist lawyer, and was a Yale Law School professor.
Yeah.
And I swear to God, her day job is that she's a war crimes prosecutor at The Hague.
Okay.
Like, you do not mess with Catherine McKinnon.
Right. Yeah. Right. And she represented Linda.
And also oversaw my writing. So,
yeah. Okay, so, right. so this
she
was
did.
Done
so
this was
she
done with the blessing of the estate?
Yeah, the estate and Linda's lawyer, who you do not mess with.
Yeah.
So
it's a favorable portrayal of her.
No, it was an accurate portrayal.
Okay.
I mean, it was 100% accurate.
You hear that answer right there?
That was good.
That's Andy Bellin.
Right there.
It was a setup.
Yeah. He's holding up a sign, ladies and gentlemen. And, you know, Linda's kids were there. She saw it. They saw it at Sundance, and they were really happy. So.
Well, then did that make it hard for you to explore the, you know,
well,
the confusion about what happened or the discrepancies over what happened?
No, because I think that the those issues are bold-faced regardless whether I'm talking about them or not. These kids are well aware of them. They're, you know, free-thinking, autonomous people who have access to the internet. They know what's going on. So it's out there, and I think they would have seen it as cheap or pandering if we hadn't discussed this.
Sure.
So.
How old are her kids?
They're, I think late 20s.
So they were born well after her. She had retired?
Yeah, retired, but Linda never escaped that movie. I mean, as she said, she spent 17 days of her life in pornography and has spent the rest of her life living it down. That no matter where she went, she was working at, like, fucking Walgreens and stuff, and then some kid would recognize her and start, like, pretending to jerk off, and then she'd have to quit.
Right.
So
do you cover that span in the movie or post pornography?
You know, that was originally in the script, and we shot some of it. It just it was just too much. It ended up not making it in.
And so what time period do you guys cover, or is that, am I at liberty to ask you that?
Yeah, you're at liberty. Okay. I can say go fuck yourself.
Go ahead,
Heffern, and go fuck
yourself. Go talk to Attorney McKinnon when you do that.
Yeah, are you familiar with The Hague?
We cover from when Chuck first met her, so she was a teenager.
Yeah.
To her, basically her, she testified before Congress, which was the 80s.
Against pornography?
Yeah, and also just explaining that not just anti-porn, although she was anti-porn, but she was also trying to say that the people involved in pornography need protection as well, because it was widely unlicensed. And today there's almost a union. I mean, the health checks, and it's mostly
condoms.
Because, it's the work that Linda did and Catherine as well.
Huh. Do you? I was going to ask about the selling of the movie, or do you have other ones about the making?
No. I wanted to talk. Yeah, about
I hear that's a cool story. And so you shot this film. They shot it independently, or do they?
Yeah, I mean, we had a studio behind us with Millennium Films.
Yeah, sure.
Who the sort of guy who runs it, Avi Lerner, is a really sort of wonderfully colorful guy, and they make, you know, The Expendables and stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they released the last movie, The Baby Makers.
They end up falling in love with very few sort of passion projects, and this happened to be one of them.
Sure, sure.
And Avi actually gave us a license to really make this great movie. And, you know, Avi's pretty smart. On the strength of the cast, we've sold a lot of the foreign rights. And then we took it to Sundance and had no distributor, and we very easily could have walked out of Sundance.
So Millennium doesn't distribute?
No. We were distributed by Weinstein.
Okay. Well, so there's a good story. Is that a...
Well, before we get to Sundance, so how did it come together? You got Amanda attached first? Is that
the first person we had attached was Kate Hudson.
Okay. To play
Linda. And then she got pregnant and did not want to... You know, and then we had Olivia Wilde.
Okay.
And then she ended up going off and, like, saving the world and doing something wonderful for children. And
Was John Carter from Mars going to play Mitch Traynor at any point in time?
He wanted to. Chuck Traynor.
Chuck Traynor, I mean. Who's Mitch Traynor?
I don't know.
Is he a pitcher?
Is he a gymnast?
That's Mitch Gaylord. Okay, go. Do it. Velen, go.
He gave, like, the best audition I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah. Who did? The Taylor
Kitsch.
Kitsch, yeah.
The kid was awesome.
Yeah.
And then we just ended up with Sarsgaard.
But this was before he came out with Battleship and John Carter from Mars, and I think...
He did Friday Night Lights.
No, I know, but I think Avi, like, didn't know...
Who he was.
No, but I mean, I remember the Battleship trailer, and, you know, Avi loves action, and I was like, now that's porn, you know, to Avi, because everything was blowing up, and this is like the best looking guy in America, and he was like making out with Brooklyn Decker, and it was like, wow, that's all pretty hot, you know, I want to have sex with a battleship.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
So, but he was just awesome, but I don't know how we ended up with I just know that Peter was reading it also, and then when Peter... You know, Peter was a tough sell. Yeah, I mean, look, it's a really scary part. It's unforgiving.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of actors who read it were like, I don't think I want to be that kind of dick.
Yeah.
And Sarsgaard just did it and did it relentlessly. And he saved the movie, if not for his devotion to the part. We're dead. So he was just amazing.
Okay, so he's the first attachment then?
No, we never really had a guy attached. We circled a bunch of guys, but Sarsgaard was the first guy that, you know, I forgot who suggested him. I think it might have been Amanda's agent who was like, what about Peter Sarsgaard? And we all flipped, and I just knew him. As, he's just a wonderful
man. We went to the same high school.
No, yeah, you didn't. No, he just texted me. He said, no, you didn't.
Yeah, you did. never heard of him.
We did. We actually did.
Okay.
Where did you shoot it?
We shot it in Los Angeles, California.
Oh, right here, locally.
Yeah.
Okay.
Where was the real Deep Throat shot?
Miami.
Okay.
And then we ended up just kept getting crazier and crazier, but I was in New York, and I kept getting texts like, hey, this is who we have for this part. And then we ended up with Sharon Stone for the mom, and then we ended up with James Franco for Hefner, and then my buddy Hank Azaria came on to play Damiano, and then we got Bobby Cannavale, and it just kept
Demi Moore came on to play Gloria Steinem.
And then she dropped out suddenly, and then we only had 2 days to sort of...
Find your Gloria Steinem.
Yeah, but that's the part that didn't make it into the movie.
Oh, okay.
So,
No, but I remember it was very exciting, you know, as a friend of Andy's, you know, we knew he was writing the script or had written the script.
Yeah.
And literally it was like, that was last summer that you would just see on the ticker on like CNN.
Yeah.
It'd be like, Demi Moore, you know, joins the cast as Gloria Steinem.
It just was crazy. It was just bananas.
Well, I mean, it's pun intended, it's a sexy... piece of material, right?
That's not even a pun, really, but
yeah, kind of funny.
And you know who would know that?
Kind of funny.
Sarsgaard would know that from high
ask
school.
Ask him. We can ask him. We had the same English teacher in high school.
Oh, yeah. See, now look. Now you guys are going back and forth. Yeah, I like this.
And now, were you involved? Like, were you there? Were you on the set? Were you, like, you know, people don't know what writers do when the movies get shot. I mean, tell us what you're doing.
Writers on movie sets do nothing.
They do nothing, right?
Yeah.
They are shunned.
But you have to get on that set. I mean, like, look, all the culture and the intelligence and highbrow aside.
All the bullshit aside.
You still want to. That set. There's got to be a lot of shit going on.
Two things. First of all, unlike most writers who in their contract put, like, I want to be on set for X number of days, I do not want to be on set. I am very self-conscious. I don't enjoy it. It's boring as hell.
Yeah.
I just kind of stand around and people are like, please don't stand there. I'm like, oh, right. Excuse me.
Sorry, I'm in the wrong place.
Can you get out of my eye?
Like, you feel almost like you're out of the picture now. You know what I mean?
It's uncomfortable. You know, Sarsgaard shows up and says whatever he wants to. It has nothing to do with the script. And it's 87 times better than what I wrote. God bless him.
Sure. Right.
And he's like, did you like that? I'm like, I kind of did.
Yeah, it's really good. Yeah. Can you come write my next script with me?
Okay, so.
So you're on the set for...
Okay, so then I do show up, and of course it is the first, and this is random, and I swear to God it's random, but I showed up for the first topless Amanda Day. And literally I'm walking up like, hey, Amanda, and she's putting on her robe, and I'm like, I'm so sorry.
Did you meet her before, before you started shooting?
Yeah, I met her once or twice,
Now, what was the nature of that? Was that to, like, meet her and get her take or her ideas and, you know?
Yeah, she was... she was in the, the table read, and she was really helpful, and she's just a really smart, insightful, creative
creature,
collaborator, whatever. She's
actress.
Just actress, actor.
Yeah.
And of course I show up the first day that she's like naked in a pool, which I apologize for, and then just ogled her all day.
Okay, so Sarsgaard, obviously he's got to make a serious mental adjustment to play a part like that. How about her? I mean, that's got to be...
This is the bravest, most badass part, because she also did it fearlessly. You know, there's a lot of nudity. It's a very physical part. And the truth was that she was not a virgin, but she had almost no experience when Linda had met her husband. And there's this horrible story of their wedding night and him finally being like, oh, now that we're married, this is what I'm really into. And it was misogynistic and violent.
Right.
And I wrote this awful, awful wedding night scene.
Right.
And of course, there's just, I don't know how this happens in movies, but it's like their first day together, you know?
Yes, yeah.
And Peter's got it. I mean, he's beating the shit out of her. Mm. And we're all just sitting there just like, oh, God. And then he's raping her. And then raping her. And it's awful. And we're all just frozen. And then we cut. And then we're all sitting there stupid in silence. And just Amanda pops up. And she's like, all right, I'm ready to get raped again. And we were just like, God bless you. Thank you for being so awesome. And
making
so,
it less, you know, uncomfortable.
Yeah, because, man.
Or more comfortable.
Yeah.
I guess you can't say
but
more
she's comfortable. But she was tough and brave. And it's she's going
to... Oscar.
Yeah, she's going to be... she's going to be pushed for it. I hope, yeah, she, sure, I hope sure. she gets some recognition for it.
How... Did you do the blowjobs?
No. You know, here's the thing. I'm not gonna say it. Other than Rob Epstein and Jeffrey Friedman are geniuses,
wonderful directors. Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
Wonderful Heard directors that. who have apparently received blowjobs in their day because it looks awesome.
Okay. Okay.
So, was there a bidding war when you guys went to Sundance? How did that work out?
There was no bidding war because it was the dream experience. I mean, it was just
you had a great screen. Like what? Like you just had an awesome
had a
screening.
Huge or? Screening in the big house with 1,200
people or whatever.
And it was packed and it was awesome. Yeah. And then.
And you were there?
I was there. Good. And I was squirming. And
yeah, but you have an interesting perspective on it. I mean, you wrote, I thought, a great article.
Oh, in the New York Observer. Yeah. That was a fun experience. Also, I used to be a journalist and I actually.
Still are.
Yeah.
Well, now
which back we'll
to
get to.
Yeah. Okay.
We'll get to that. Which sorry, we'll just tease it.
We're
Andy.
Spending, we're, you know, we're doing our 30-minute.
But that's good. This is a, you know, this is the big movie
I'm into
out.
It, Kev. I'm into it. I'm about to swallow this microphone right good. Here is how into it I am.
I keep hearing that this is a fun Sundance story.
Okay. But right. So, you know, we've
we'll
been
get to that later.
Yeah, let's tease it.
Oh, no, we're on it.
Oh, here we are.
But you have an interesting perspective.
Go read the New York Observer article. Okay, let's move on, everyone.
Sassy today, Kev.
I bring that out.
You
Kevin.
Do. You do. Heffernan has a secret crush on you. And,
I love
and you,
Queen.
I do.
Yeah,
you
I
him.
I mean, yes, I do. Yes, I do.
I said Queen was my favorite.
Yeah. I thought you said Soder was your favorite.
I thought Soder was the evil genius behind you guys.
Right.
I thought Jay was the worst actor I'd ever seen in my life.
Could be. Could be. Could be.
And I thought Mink was like one of the nicest people I'd ever met.
Okay.
Before.
And we know that you
all superlatives.
Have a crush on Kevin.
And Kev is my favorite.
And me. And where do I fit in?
You're the dirty whore.
Yeah.
All,
you're the sloppy slut.
At least I've got all my teeth. What?
Oh,
shut
no.
up.
All right, okay. Let me pull it back to the Sundance story that I've heard so much.
Yeah, we'll get back to that. We'll get to that.
Let's do that.
Yeah.
Let's jump into that.
No, yeah. no, yeah, no.
Yeah, go.
So I don't know what the Observer story was. Just
well,
that
was,
I wrote about it.
It was very, you know, it was cool, and it touched me because you know it covers the Sundance experience from
yeah,
start to
yeah.
finish.
It's such a vulnerable experience.
Oh, yeah.
And you know, you're sitting there, and the truth is that you just never. I mean, I don't care what the focus groups say or anything. You just never know if your movie's any good until
you have
no
fucking clue what the audience is going
to do. Until you get it in front of an unbiased audience.
Yeah.
And this was a pretty unbiased audience. There's a lot of people in a high school gymnasium.
Yeah.
sorry, go ahead.
No.
By the way, you know, for people who don't know, there are tens of thousands of films submitted to the Sundance Film Festival. And so just waiting to hear if you're going to get in is a terrifying thing. And when you finally do get in, of course, you're ecstatic. And you think everything is all right then, but then you actually go into the biggest pressure cooker.
Yeah, because a lot of those things you don't have, you know, these kind of independent films, they don't have money to do focus groups or they don't have any of that kind of stuff. And our movies, we didn't do that. You just go there and that's the first time the audience sees it. You know?
Yeah, we were pretty flying blind. And, you know, for every good Sundance story you hear, there are 1,000 awful ones.
Yeah,
and
sure.
I actually knew of two very good friends of you guys with a phenomenal experience when you sold Super Troopers.
Yeah. Versus Puddle Cruiser.
We had a terrible experience before that. Yeah.
And and then my buddy Stu Blumberg did The Kids Are All Right and texted me. He was like, you know, were they hit a Sundance? I was like, I texted him back. I was like, how do you know? And he texted back after like an hour, pretty drunk and misspelled every word. Yeah. And he's like, oh, you know. and I just, that was going through my mind all the time. I remember how happy you were, Lemmy, when you guys had sold it and you told me. And I was so angry and jealous that it wasn't happening to me. And then, you know, you're sitting there and you just, the whole movie, you're not watching the movie. You're thinking, did they laugh enough? And why did they cut? And I'm angry at the editor for cutting this thing. And that would have been funnier. And what was I thinking when I wrote that awful line?
Yeah.
And, you know, every laugh was not big enough. Every sort of sigh and gasp was not meaningful enough.
But from an objective point of view, it was, though. I mean, it was a great screening, right? Objectively, you had a problem with it. But
I leaned over. I was with my wife, Kate, and a dear friend, Adam Tomei, who's in the movie.
Okay.
And I was like, this is awful. And Adam looked at me. He goes, are you fucking nuts? It was just...
It's going great.
But you know, you and I have this conversation often, which is like, Kevin loves that first screening in front of the audience.
God, I can't wait for it.
And I hate it. I hate it with a passion. Oh, I don't even want to be in there.
I almost didn't sit through it. My wife's like, you're out of your mind. She was like, this is a once-in-a-lifetime experience, so you have to go.
Yeah. Right.
But I tried to not go, and everybody was like, you're out of your mind. Sarsgaard was like, you're a fucking idiot. Just go.
Just go. You got to go.
But so then, okay, so then, and after those Sundance screenings, they have a panel where they bring up the filmmakers.
Well, yeah,
Q&A kind of
thing. But even before this happened, and this was really unbelievable, but just sort of like, so we have this really just magical moment with Amanda and Sharon Stone at the end, and it's really heartbreaking, and, you know, whatever the issues were that separated them, we're working them out, and it's this magnificent thing. And then all of a sudden our financier, Avi Lerner, just stands up. It's the movie still going. He just stands up and starts walking out the movie theater.
Yeah.
And I grabbed the director, Rob, and I was like, what's happening?
Oh my God.
And he turned to me like with a frozen smile. He goes, I don't know. And Avi just started walking, and I was like, what the fuck is he doing? And then I sort of looked over, and standing at the end of the aisle was a very familiar shape I couldn't see, but it was Harvey Weinstein.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And Harvey and Mark Gill and Avi Harvey just pulled them outside, and I swear to God, he held the door closed so nobody else could talk to these guys and bought it right there.
That's fantastic. So right on the spot.
Boom. Right on the spot. I mean, by the time...
Avi must have gotten a text while he was sitting in the room, said, talk to me.
We were on stage when people were whispering to us, like, you just sold it. I was like, you got to be kidding me. And I said out loud in a very public place, this is just like on Entourage. And Peter Sarsgaard was like, don't say that out loud.
Yeah. But those are the great moments.
It was one of the great Sundance moments of my life. I was with my wife, my amazing wife, and a bunch of friends, and we went to this party, and, it was just...
It's almost embarrassing how happy you act that night.
You know what? I had a moment of like, please don't be that guy. And then I was like, oh no, I'm going to be that guy.
Yeah.
Like, I'm going to be that guy who's drunk and laughing, because honestly, like, it was awesome.
Oh, did you ever hear the Chandra Sekhar story about when we sold Super Troopers?
No.
We sold Super Troopers, and it was the first, you know, that first night, the first screening, and the next day, it's like Sunday, and we had a friend who was there also, and she relayed the story to us, but she was walking up, you know, Main Street up the hill, and Jay was coming the other direction on his cell phone. And as they crossed, the quote that she heard him saying into the phone was, I feel like I'm the belle of the ball. That was the Chandra Sekhar quote. I'm the belle of the ball.
That one made it to us before he even got back to the house.
Yeah, because like, then she called us, and then when he walked in the door, we're like, here comes the belle of the ball.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
But there was the also...
But that's how you feel. Yeah. You feel like the belle of the ball.
But the euphoria... I mean, first of all, there are like the Harvey Weinstein story. I mean, there are so many different versions of that story, whether it was fist fights breaking out between distributors.
Sure.
I mean, sometimes these guys have to get physical.
It's the excitement of Sundance.
But we had a funny one, which was... you know, we were celebrating.
I thought we were talking about me.
Yeah, but we are.
We like to break off talk about us first.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
But I'm the quarterback, and I'm calling an audible.
Right. We'll get back to you.
Yeah, we're coming back to you. It relates. No, we were having a party at the condo that we had all rented, and we were partying and celebrating. And I was talking to Andre Vipolis, who's the driver in the front seat of the Super Troopers of the car in the opening scene. And we're just living up, laughing, and Rich Perillo, our producer, gets up, and he stands up on a chair, and he's like, all right, everyone, I just want to thank you all for participating and for coming here and being a part of this moment with us, and I can't believe we sold a movie. And everyone cheers, and Andre turns to me, and he goes, wait, we sold the movie? I was like, yeah, what the fuck do you think we're celebrating? He's like, I thought we were just partying, man.
Congrats,
but it's like,
dude.
But you are like, after that, it's so much tension is released. It's
amazing. I had such a miserable time before and had such a wonderful time after.
And that was this past Sundance, right?
Yeah,
so this
a couple
January,
of months ago. Yeah.
And so then they put the wheels in motion. They give you a release date. It's all moving forward. August 9th.
Yeah.
And is it going to go like wide, or does it start small and go wide?
I think we're starting in 250 theaters, and it's called a day and date, which is a platform release, and what Radius does really, really well, and hopefully we'd make a ton of money and make a lot of people happy.
Sure.
Did it? And I'm assuming it played exciting in Cannes. Did you go?
It did not play in Cannes. Okay. No, we went to Berlin, which apparently was amazing, and I got snowed in by hurricane something, we weren't allowed out. But and then it's playing at Ischia because I think Avi wants to go to Ischia, so I'm going there.
Okay. All right. Yeah, it's in your contract, right?
Yeah.
If we go to Ischia, I'm going.
I'm Italian, so.
I'm there.
Yeah.
Andrea Della Croce. Yeah. Is an Italian citizen.
Yeah.
A fact.
Oh, really?
A
fact. Are you a U.S. citizen at all or no?
I am a dual citizen. You're a dual citizenship. But okay. My best friend from growing up didn't know that until like last week.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Well, because it was funny because he was like talking about how his son, you know, our kids are baby boys are pretty much the same age.
Right.
And he was talking about how they just got him an Italian passport or something. And I was like, what does he need an Italian passport for? And he's like, well, you know, because, you know, I'm an Italian citizen. That's, you know, we're going to go. We go all the time and everything. I was like, bullshit. You're not an Italian citizen.
I've known you for how many years? When did you guys meet?
Well, we met. It's interesting because I actually knew.
I'm moving off Loveless now.
Oh, sure. Pronounced Lovelace, not Loveless.
Yeah.
But isn't that the beautiful kind of irony of it?
Yes, it goes both ways.
Yeah, if there's a fool who mispronounces her name throughout the entire movie, then yes, it will be ironic.
Right. Well, just Loveless.
And poetic.
Right.
Andy and I became friends when we were 12.
Okay.
And,
is that what?
Well, no. I'd actually known him. Like his family was pretty, you know.
Yeah, go for it. Sure, sure.
Well known
Throughout New York City.
Throughout New York City. Andy comes from, you know, from like a very popular socialite family.
Yeah.
And
my mother was the first topless photo of a photo of her taken by Richard Avedon.
Wow.
She was a model and an actress.
Do you have that photo?
I do. It's a very famous photo.
Does it make you uncomfortable? That's what I'm talking
about.
It makes me very comfortable.
Yeah, okay. She's pretty hot.
Okay.
And it hung in at the Museum of Modern Art in New York.
Wow.
at this Avedon opening. And of course, you know, try being 8 years old and having a picture of your naked mother hanging
weird.
For the public to see.
That's weird.
So,
yeah. But Andy's mom was also a countess.
Okay.
Yeah.
Italian countess. Wonderful lady. My second mother.
Yes, she was the best.
So they're very open family, like when you know, in the summertime and on Christmas and spring vacations, they would send their itinerary to, I think, everyone in the school, just say like, hey, this is our plan. If you happen to be in this location, let us know and we can make plans or something like
that.
Which was interesting because I remember that like a lot of people thought that was cool, but it also frightened some people.
Yeah, I mean there were I think there were certain members of our school that were not allowed over at our house, which, by the way, you know, now with a kid, like, that seems reasonable.
Yeah,
it totally does. In fact, you know, after I'd become friends with Andy, there was the neighbors, I'm getting ahead of how we met, but like Andy and I, for instance, used to play soccer on the terrace.
Right.
And the terrace at the end of it was like a wood, not a picket fence, but like a thatch.
Yeah, it was a fence.
Separating two balconies. Okay. That was where the goal area was.
Right. So you kicked that ball into
We would blast soccer balls at each other, and, you know, it's like it would just slam into the fence, and like they're on the other side with having tea parties.
Right, having spent millions of dollars live on Park Avenue, and these two assholes are kicking a soccer ball.
Yeah, and then sometimes a ball would come flying over and like smash into the table. Yeah. And we'd come climbing over.
Get that ball back, please.
But so there was a fire.
Yeah, but I mean, even before that, like, just to go back to my family, my father would go on these ridiculous trips and he would come back and be like, hi boys, how are you? Look what I got you from Madagascar. And he would hand us two machetes.
Okay.
He would open those machetes.
Yeah. So what do you do with a machete if you're 10 years old?
A sword fight.
And you chop the shit out of your beds.
Yeah.
So my mom came home and was like, ah! Like, we had cut our beds to ribbons.
Was your dad just clueless about, you know, kids?
No, he thought this was how you raised a child.
Yeah. No, Howie was a wild man.
Still is.
He really is. He really is. Howie is like the original 70s party machine. Like he was, you know.
Yeah.
And really 80s.
Yeah, he was, you know, he would say this with great pride that he was sort of a, you know, if there was a plaque at Plato's retreat, you know, like retired numbers or whatever, retired chest hair or whatever. Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah. When I was out at his house in Millbrook last summer, there's a photo of him and Mick Jagger.
Okay. Wow.
But it's funny because his back.
Actually great. It's great. Yeah.
His back, Howard's back is to the camera.
Yeah.
And so it's very clearly Mick Jagger's face, and then it's Howard's back, but Howard has put in like a little typewritten thing.
Me?
Howard Bell.
Howard Bell. like it appeared in the newspapers.
Was it just like they were walking past each other in a crowd, or was it like
no, it was at Studio 54. My parents were the king and queen of Studio 54.
Studio 54.
Yeah, I had my 14th birthday there.
Okay.
We used to go to
Studio 54 at 14. We were like where there were 1,000 people lined up to get in.
Right.
Lemmy and I would walk up at 14 years old, be, hi! And people would, they would open, Mark Benneke would open the gates and we'd get in.
But I remember the early times, it's like, we would go with your mom. Yeah. And she would show up
bell bottom,
and she'd be like, "I want to like bring my son and his friends," and he'd be like, "Oh, really, Contessa? Are you?" So she's like, "Yes," and they'd be like, "Oh, fuck! All right, meet us at the back door." Like and we would walk. I mean, we're children, you know,
right.
Walking
children, literally children.
Right, right.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so now Andy and I, we met when we were 12.
Yeah.
And at that time,
a couple of New York City kids.
Well, you know, my mother was a teacher at the Dalton
That's
School.
Right. Yeah.
And so I originally had a scholarship to go there.
Right.
But, you know.
That's another story.
That is another story.
Originally.
Yeah. But I lost that scholarship eventually, pretty quickly.
Yeah.
And, but we didn't have a lot of money. And so, like, to buy an Atari, which was had just come out.
Yeah.
You know, I got a summer job. I saved up my money.
Right.
And, like, you know, I bought the Atari.
Okay.
And my best friend at the time, a guy named Alex Levy, also
awesome.
Had an Atari.
Awesome.
Okay.
And then... but then the misplay was that I didn't realize that the cartridges,
sure,
the game cartridges,
the games.
And were expensive.
Yeah. That's
where they get you. So the game comes with combat, which is like the little tank
sure.
game right. and everything like that. But that
the default game.
It sucks.
Yeah.
And I had no games. And Alex Levy was like, you know, I hear that there's this kid named Andy Bellin who's so rich that he's got duplicates of every game lying around his house, because what'll happen is he'll misplace one and then the maid will just go out and buy another copy and then he'll misplace that.
And I love that my video games were like urban legend.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, yeah.
They're just everywhere.
That's what they're
saying. Everywhere. You yeah, open the door. Yeah.
As far as the eye can see.
I'm in the fridge.
Row after endless row. Yeah. Well, so Andy and I were on the soccer team together.
Yeah.
And I said, all right, well, I'm gonna infiltrate. I'm going to get to know this guy.
Okay.
And I befriended Andy.
By the way,
holy
this was
shit.
Like he,
this is similar
he,
to our meeting story.
And he concocted, like, he and Alex Levy were sitting there twirling their mustaches, like, how do we get into the Bellin house?
Yeah. Exactly, yeah.
Like, you befriend him. No, you befriend
yeah.
him.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's like the Expendables.
Right.
And so I befriended Andy. And very graciously, because Andy has always been a very hospitable person,
sure.
that day he said, hey, you know, we always hang out at my house after practice. Why don't you come?
Yeah, here you go.
See, I was not classist. I wasn't like, no, you
right.
poor
you little,
scholarship child.
You little Hispanic punk.
Yeah. No, he invited
thief.
Me.
Yeah.
He didn't know that yet.
And how did you repay my
well,
kindness?
And so I went over to Andy's house, yeah. and sure enough, it was true. There were copies of games everywhere.
Like multiples? Or
multiples.
Yeah,
there
okay.
were not multiples, but go on.
Yeah. There were multiples.
Okay.
And
what'd you steal?
Well, and I had a great time. First of all, like Andy, we hit it off. Like we were hanging out laughing, playing video games, laughing. I had a great time. I still robbed him blind.
Yeah. I can imagine.
I stole Superman. I remember being at home that night, like late night, playing Superman. Like, yeah. Mission accomplished. And a game called Adventure. Remember Adventure was like a dragon game
yeah,
with
yeah,
like
yeah.
an
Sounds
arrow.
Good, yeah.
And maybe
that's the one that my brother killed himself because he lost Adventure.
Go on. Hello. It's funny. I know him so well, but you know, I don't know. He's
wait,
an Italian
brother.
Citizen. I'm like, wait a second.
Wait a
did that happen? And then, you know, but then Andy and I started hanging out pretty much every day, and quickly I stopped being friends with Alex Levy.
Oh, my God.
Because he'd be like, what the fuck? You're losing sight of the mission, man. What the fuck? You're going to the other side, man. I don't even know who you are anymore. And I was like, no, this guy's fucking cool. And
I'm
we have
so
a good
deep
time.
Undercover, I've lost myself.
Yeah, nah. Yeah, and so, like, so anyway, we became friends. I did confess
okay.
my crime.
Okay.
Like, you know, what, 15 years later or something like that?
Yeah, it's right around the same time you admitted you were Puerto Rican.
Well, that happened a lot later.
Which, if you knew that, you wouldn't have invited him into your house after soccer?
No, but I just would have kept a hold of stuff, kept a better eye
sure.
on my adventure cartridge.
Well,
sure.
here's the thing. Here's the thing, though, about the Puerto Rican thing, and I'm glad you brought that up, because I had forgotten about that, was, like, in New York at the time.
Yeah.
Puerto Ricans were not necessarily well regarded.
Sure, okay.
And in our group of friends,
yeah.
we had a whole, I mean, it was a mix. We were a motley crew. Like, we had one friend was half black, half Japanese. We had another friend was half Korean, half Jewish. And I was, you know, Argentinian.
Right. Self-proclaimed Argentinian.
Oh, right.
Now, if I had said I was part Puerto Rican, I would have been, and, like, because we were racist with each other.
Yeah.
Like, we would put each other down,
uh-huh.
you know?
Sure.
And like, Well, I won't say what we said because people will take it the wrong way out of context. But we nothing was off limits.
Yeah, right. These are our best friends. Yeah, you know, we're all, you know.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, and so like, but
and so there's a point they found.
Well, no. If I had said I was Puerto Rican, that would have been a huge chink in my armor.
Okay.
I mean, that was because they would have gone after
meaning
me.
They just would. I mean, in a good natured way, they would have made fun of you.
Well,
it's not like they would have ostracized you. Somehow.
No, they would never have ostracized me. But I mean, they actually called me Puerto Rican anyway. Like, because right. that's the part that
always made me feel slightly better was that, you know, you were by default Puerto Rican.
He really was Puerto Rican.
And yeah, so there never a truer word said.
Yeah, it was. And Andy was he was half Jewish and everything. Our thing with him was that he had fake teeth,
right,
and that he was balding.
Right. And like I was balding at like 16, and my father never had hair.
Yeah, right. He was
and
bald
the fact
good.
That I
looks good now, bro.
I know the fact that I have hair is such a tremendous disappointment to Steve Lemmy. I cannot tell you.
He ripped us off. He
wanted the bald head.
He has like teed up.
I resent this. It was bullshit. He denied us of our right.
You want to see him bald?
Well, we would always talk about it. We'd be like
it's going to happen.
It'll happen.
It'll probably happen, in my
it'll happen.
Mid-50s.
But it looks terrific.
It looks great.
It looks terrific. It's Propecia. It's Propecia.
Did you guys know that you were going to high school together? Did you know that you end up in high school together?
Well, I mean, the school was, K through 12.
Oh, so you still, okay, gotcha. So even at 12 years old.
Yeah.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah, now to be fair, so all the thievery aside and everything, Andy and I also had slightly dysfunctional families, and that was something we bonded about.
Mm-hmm.
And,
we also had a... We like to smoke weed.
Okay, there you go.
We bonded about that, too.
At age 12?
We started smoking weed around
13,
age
I think.
13. We went to Jamaica together.
Raise your kids in New York City, everybody. At 13, you guys went to Jamaica together?
Yeah, man.
Yeah.
With who? Bellin's parents?
Bellin's mom and grandma.
And grandma. And the best thing about it is my brother, God bless him, was, my brother smoked some weed in his day. And... Mm-hmm. As did I, but we were coming back through U.S. Customs, U.S. Customs, and Lemmy and I are walking back, two little stupid kids carrying our lacrosse.
Right. Age 13, 14.
13, okay. And gotcha. Marco, my brother, who's already passed through security, he's like, don't drop your lacrosse sticks, guys. And we were like, why? And he said, because they're full of weed. And just kind of ducked through security. He's like, bye. Uh-huh. And then we were drug smugglers because my brother thought it was
so
funny.
So he busted you.
No, he
just did. let us know oh, okay. Before the fact that we were mules.
Right.
Okay, got it. You never were caught, but
we did not get caught, but you had some liberties to take with
sure,
your
with
14-year-old brother. And also, if you're going to do
good
that,
prank.
Why tell us right before we're going
exactly.
through?
It's to freak out. It's probably the worst possible time, clearly.
Yeah. Just to freak you out, that's why.
Yeah. Well, that's my brother.
Yeah, but so, we would get stoned. I mean, also, and I will say this, I give Andy shit about being rich.
Yeah.
And I hope I don't get emotional because, I always cry. I always cry
when
we talk about the high school days. No.
He cries all the time.
Uh-huh. He would invite me on vacations and I'd be like, right. I can't go. And he'd be like, I'll pay for your plane ticket and your hotel. Just pay
right.
for food.
Right.
And so I would go, eighth grade was Jamaica. I think ninth grade was St. Croix.
You keep a tab on this guy or what?
Dude,
what's the tab at right now?
I'd like to, you don't even want to know.
I mean, there's some place you got to pay that shit off.
It's a child. It's a child.
It's a child.
Yeah,
he owes you a child.
He let me keep my firstborn, but I think the next one is his.
Yeah,
and Andy also had an open door policy. Like I said, a very hospitable guy. Like his was the door that was always the front door was unlocked. I actually didn't have to call to go over there, and nobody did. We would just show up.
And my mom took great care of all my friends.
Yeah,
she would. They would just walk in, and she would just
nice photograph.
Well, actually, the first time I went over to their house. This is the first time I'd met this stunningly beautiful woman, and she said, okay, Andy, I hope your new friend doesn't mind the sight of a naked woman because I'm going to take a shower.
Hello.
And then, I saw her walking around a little while later.
Yeah,
naked.
These were very progressive people.
Nice.
Yeah, I was into it.
That's good. That's how I envisioned growing up in New York City as a kid growing up in Connecticut.
Snorting coke and
getting high at 13.
Naked ladies.
Flying to Jamaica.
Naked ladies.
Yeah.
And Studio 54.
Yeah, Studio 54.
Sure.
Yeah, but so, it was. But I would say this, a lot of the best adjusted people I met in high school in terms of drugs were the kids from New York City because they'd been through it.
I stopped doing drugs probably, for the most part, other than the prescription kind, probably at the end of high school.
Yeah.
Right. You were done.
Yeah. No, been there, done that.
Been there, done that.
Yeah.
So high school.
So high school was good.
Yeah.
You guys were, you had some high-profile friends out there in high school.
There were a lot of, well, I mean, that was a pretty well-to-do.
Great transition.
Yeah. I mean, it's a well-to-do school. There were a lot of children of celebrities.
Yeah.
A lot of, you know.
Anderson Cooper went to your high school.
He did. I like what you're doing here.
Was he he a friend? Did you guys hang out with him, or was it?
He was a couple. He was a year or two older.
Year older.
Year older.
Did
than
he have?
You, 2 years
have
older.
That's right. That's right.
Oh, Lemmy, hello.
Lemmy was in a couple of different years.
I know.
Yeah.
Even in college, he was too. What did he have? Did he have shockingly white hair back then too, or was
no,
he was
just
it brown?
A really
was it red?
Handsome,
was it
dark haired, handsome kid? Very nice.
Not Lemmy. I'm talking about Anderson Cooper.
Oh, yeah. No, that's who I was talking about.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Dark hair.
Okay. Did he have dark hair, really?
He did.
He wasn't
gray.
Did
you guys call him Coop?
He kept, I mean, I guess he's out now. I mean, he is, isn't he? Yeah, he is.
Is he?
Yeah, he is.
No, he is.
He absolutely is. He absolutely is.
Are you sure?
Oh, he absolutely
my heart's gonna be. Yeah, he absolutely is.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
We weren't friends. I mean, he was older than us.
Yeah, but he was a...
He was friends...
He was friends with, you know...
A bunch of girls.
But that had nothing to do with
he
it.
He was, though. I'm just saying...
He was friends with...
We
yeah,
weren't... He didn't...
Crew. Yeah, we weren't on his radar. We were young, stupid
okay.
kids.
Yeah. Okay. He was good friends with Dylan McDonald.
Yeah. A lot of the cooler, older kids.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so we certainly knew him. Everyone... It was a small school. We all knew
and so
each other.
He kind of knew who you were and he...
I would think so.
Well, I'm doing this because of
together.
The story that happened
We've
with
We've partied
Bellin.
With Anderson Cooper. I've partied with Anderson
Sure, sure, yeah. And you're in the day, back in high school.
Back in the day.
Right. And then...
Oh, you guys came over to my house. Do you remember that?
I do.
You and Anderson?
Me and Anderson
and
Dylan.
And Dylan.
We're partying.
Partying. Yeah.
We were partying.
You're just partying.
And it was pretty...
Showed up at my house.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Partying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so... But there's the story now that involves Bellin about you crossing paths with Anderson Cooper in our current day.
Yeah.
Which I love that story.
Okay, so we were writing a script.
For Universal.
For Universal. And where we play some college professors.
Yeah. And it was very close. It was very close to getting made. We were in the casting process.
Very close to getting made. And one of the things we were trying to cast
Is
up.
Is this the Greek Road?
No, it's called Rogue Scholars, it was called.
Yeah.
Clever. You guys are clever.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Play on words.
The lizards.
You like that shit?
Yeah.
And so...
It's about, you know, a bunch of rogue professors.
I get it already.
You know, I get it.
You don't have to say it twice.
I get it.
Yeah, but we wrote that the alumni, one of the alumni members of this school, one of them was Anderson Cooper.
Right. As a cameo, you know, we wanted Anderson to come play this part.
Yeah.
Right.
And a cameo in this movie.
Yeah. And so... You know, because I had told the Broken Lizard guys that, you know,
you
I
went
could,
to high school with them.
Went to high school with him, and so they said, "Do you think you could call him and just see if we can get him on board now, and like see if it's okay to write this character?"
Right. Let's get him attached.
Yeah.
Anderson Cooper, the guy's hot. This is like 2 years ago.
Yeah, yeah. We were all at my house having have a writing meeting, and I said, "Well, I don't actually have a way of contacting him, but Bellin actually might have his number
because he's you know talks to him every once in a while or something or."
I'd like to hear the answer to this because I have spoken to Anderson Cooper since graduation twice.
Okay.
And once I ran into him in St. Bart's in an airport after a hurricane, and we were both like, fuck, that was wild. Huh?
Okay.
And
well, here, okay, so like, simmer down for a second.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, so like, I text Andy, I'm like, do you have Anderson Cooper's phone number?
Right.
And he texts me back, yes, I do.
Right.
And I said, do you think, would it be cool if I called him? Do you think he'd remember who I was? And Andy said, yeah, absolutely. Of course he would. You guys partied together.
Right, right.
And so I said, so Andy texted me his phone number, and then I said, will you call Anderson and just clear it with him, let him know I'm calling, and then text me back to let me know it's okay?
Right.
And he said, yeah. And then a few minutes went by. He said, okay, texted me. I just spoke to Anderson. He's expecting your call.
Right. And so we're sitting in the room while these texts are going on. We're like, this is exciting. Holy shit. Bellin's delivering. Boom. Like that. Anderson Cooper's expecting Steve Lemmy to call. And so Lemmy called him.
Yeah.
And we recorded it.
You did.
And we have that recording. And this is not like a bit. We're like, we got to fucking record this call because it's going to be awesome. And we did.
So I had my landline on speakerphone and all the other lizards are in the room. My heart was pounding for this.
I was so like uncomfortable and nervous about it that I got up and walked out of the room and stood outside the door and listened in because I was those moments made me uncomfortable. You know, like I thought it would be an uncomfortable moment. And then I guess what happened was you said that you Andy Bellin, you said that he was expecting the phone call.
Yes.
And that may you, not have been.
And here we go. So let's. So Katie, will you play the?
By the way, I've never heard this. So
okay. This is probably okay, this is the Anderson
very,
Cooper phone
this
call.
Is going to make me very.
Okay. Is it exciting that we have it?
It's
I think
gonna,
it's exciting.
It's going to make
I'm
me
listening, if I'm listening to the podcast, I'm like, this is fucking great. Okay. Let's do the call. All the lizard guys are in the room here.
That's Dolhansky.
Once bitten, twice shy.
Anderson?
Yes, who is this?
This is Steve Lemmy. How's it going?
Seriously?
I thought Andy had called you to, Andy Bowen had called you to tell you that I was calling you.
What can I do for you?
I was nervous calling you. I wasn't sure if you remembered me.
Of course I did.
Okay, good, yeah, because, we hung out. Listen, I was, I'm in a group called Broken Lizard, and we've been writing...
In your movies.
Oh, really? Oh, that's awesome. I hope you liked them.
The police one I liked a lot.
Okay, that's cool. That's cool. The others, not so much?
The other, the one that you were in the Speedo the whole time. I didn't like, but I liked that.
Okay, that's great. That's great.
My friend and I were wondering if you stopped. We just wanted to know.
If you stopped.
I had a cod piece to make me look gigantic the whole time.
I knew it.
That's great. Well, so we're 50-50 then. You like one and not the other, or aspects of the other one. I'm writing a script with these guys, and we are actually writing a part for you, and I was wondering if you would consider reading the script, where you would play yourself.
Sure. You can get my agent, yeah?
I could. Who is your agent?
I'm representative of CAA.
Oh, okay. Well, that's awesome. All right, I won't take up any more of your time. I will send it over to you, and it was good catching up with you.
Okay, who gave you my number?
Andy Bellin.
Okay.
Is that cool?
That's fine. Just, obviously don't give it out.
Obviously, I won't. All right, man, I will hopefully talk to you soon.
Great. I look forward to it.
Okay, bye.
Wow.
It had moments. But it had terrible moments.
Yeah. Yeah, good. Okay, so that's unbelievable. That was,
you left the room.
I walked out of the room because it was so fucking uncomfortable. And listening to it in retrospect, you're like, okay, maybe it's not that uncomfortable. It was, it was totally awkward. And I think the fact that like Bellin said that he had teed it up, and then we get on the phone with the guy, and it's like, I don't know what you're talking to about.
Caught by surprise.
Yeah, and I was like, oh my God, and my heart went in my stomach, and I was like, oh my God. And then they did the phone call, and then we sat there for, half an hour talking about how funny it was and the moments, and then Stolhansky pulls out the recording, and then it's like, holy shit.
But it did take the steam out of our writing session. We never got back to it.
It like, I went home and I was like, told my wife about it. I was like, holy shit, Lemmy called Anderson Cooper today. He's on the phone with him. It was the funniest thing I ever heard. Okay, so anyway.
Yeah.
So then take it from there. So that night, like, holy shit, that was a...
But I was pissed. I was like, I'm fucking calling Bellin.
Right.
That's some fucking bullshit right there.
Right.
Set me up like that.
Right.
And, I called Andy, and as it turns out, he had just given me his wife's cell phone number, which I had called, and then he had picked up, and Andy was Anderson Cooper.
That was Andy Bellin imitating Anderson Cooper.
And by the way, that is a terrible Anderson Cooper.
I think it's quite good.
No, it's
Bellin.
Not.
I think
oh
it's quite
God.
Good.
But, no, but the funny thing is that then, like, we got you on the phone the next day to talk about it. Well, like, when I told all the guys.
Right, because we were like I said, we went home, we like told our wives the Anderson Cooper thing, blah, blah, blah. And we're like, oh, this is unbelievable. And then the next day, Lemmy reveals to us that you were pranking him.
Yeah.
And we were like, oh, my God.
And then when we spoke to him and then we listened to the recording, everyone was like, holy shit, how could we not know?
Sounds just like Bellin.
It's me.
Just like Bellin.
I didn't even do anything. I just...
And so you gave him the wrong, like your wife's phone number, and then he called, and then you just picked up the phone right away and just, just went into it.
Do you not know what really happened?
What do you mean?
He does not know.
Are you kidding me?
There's one final piece of the puzzle that I've never told you, Queen.
He was in on it.
Oh, you were in on it?
I was in
You're
on it.
You're full of shit. You were in
Are
on it.
Are you kidding me? He was in on it.
You were so awkward that...
I know, but you know what?
Yeah.
Because the thing we were texting back and forth, I was like, okay, Belen, you're going to like kiss my ass and make it seem like you're a huge fan and everything like that. And then he turned it into that fucking thing.
What happened was he...
I didn't know this part. What the fuck? Okay. Hold on a second.
I know.
You know what I mean?
We've been saving this.
Well, bullshit. We've been saving it for 3 years? You've been saving this?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. What?
So he texts me and he's like, "Do you have Anderson Cooper's number?"
Right.
I said, "Sure," and I gave him my wife's number. He calls. Right. I answer the phone and I try and do an Anderson.
But he knows it's going to be you?
No.
Okay.
I just give him a number. He calls and I try and do an Anderson Cooper imitation. I'm a terrible actor and
right.
I sound nothing like Anderson. I start laughing and he right. figures out it's me.
Right.
But then he says, "Will you do me a huge favor?
Mm-hmm.
Will you just play Anderson for the guys?"
Okay.
Oh, because there was the first phone call,
but there was a hang up or something, right?
Yeah, something like that.
Okay.
Yeah, that's
exactly what it was.
So he knew what was going on. Mm-hmm. So then he played along and asked me to do it to punk you guys, which I did.
Okay.
Yeah. And now the truth comes out.
I don't know if I believe that part of it.
No.
100%. I swear to God.
Okay. But the plan was, I was like, you know, you got to make it seem like, of course, you remember me and you're a huge fucking fan. And right. I'd love to do it.
I went off script. I just thought it was more realistic that way.
Sure.
He came in with that, like, and so at that moment where I'm like, okay.
You didn't know where to go.
Well, the plan has suddenly been changed.
Okay.
And I've got Anderson Cooper on
I can
line,
maybe
so.
Buy that. Sure.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So then...
Although I will say, hearing that recording, it's so real because of
it is
like,
real.
Discomfort. Like, it does make me uncomfortable.
Right.
It made me uncomfortable because it sounds like me. It doesn't sound
like
me.
But why didn't you reveal that 4 days later when we were having a good laugh about it? Why did you wait until now?
Because, like...
Which I'm still skeptical about.
No, but...
It's 100% true.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because, like, it was so good.
Yeah. It was great.
And we were getting so much mileage out of just telling that story to people.
Sure. Okay. You don't want to puncture that.
I was like, it's so nice. And like, I mean, it's like, Kevin, when I would...
It gives all the accolades to Belen, though.
That's fine.
Because that's like Belen took you for a ride. That's how I believed it.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I guess he still did take you for a ride.
He did take me for a ride.
Yeah.
He did take me for a ride. I felt... At the time, I actually was feeling it. I was like, fucking Belen, I had a fucking plan here, and you're fucking it up.
All right. So because like, I'm like, fucking Anderson Cooper, and then the next day I'm like, fucking Belen, I should have been fucking you.
Well, you know. But like the thing is, I would look into your eyes when you'd be telling the story to everybody.
Right.
And there was such joy, and people would be so into that version of the story.
Right.
As they probably were just now, like listening to the things.
I hope so. I don't know. Katie, is that a good thing? Phone call? Okay.
And the reason I did, I mean, first of all, I found it so preposterous that he thought I had Anderson's number. Anderson's a very nice guy. I've seen him twice in my life.
You're connected, Belen. Come on. You're connected,
and he's
buddy.
A very nice guy, but I didn't have his phone number, so I thought I might as well.
But I don't feel like that. I mean, you keep in touch with a ton of people from Dalton. And also, you know, and we'll get to some of this, like in your poker playing days. I mean, you have a lot of celebrity friends. So it didn't seem...
Not if I talk about them, I don't.
Sure, no. So I won't talk about them. But then, like, it didn't seem like so far-fetched.
Yeah.
That you would have
Anderson Cooper. I mean, I believed it.
Right, well, you're, you know, you went to...
What do I know?
Yeah, you went to public school.
I know, I'm not that smart.
Yeah.
Boys Catholic school, actually.
Yeah. Okay, so that's our Anderson story thing, which was exciting. Do you remember, by the way, our wrestling days? That we were the... You remember
Pin Brothers,
we were the Pin Brothers. Andy and I were the Pin Brothers.
We were undefeated in high school.
In high school. We pinned our way through wrestling.
Did you guys, like, wrestle against girls' schools or something? Or?
Oh, boy.
No,
wow.
You did
up Whoa. With that.
But Gloria what? Steinem would like to hear you say that
who
again.
Who cares what Gloria Steinem wants?
Let me give
wants.
Catherine McKinnon a call right now.
Do it. I'll go to The Hague. Fuck it. I got a law degree. I went to high school with Peter Sarsgaard.
You're a great lawyer. You're a great
Thanks,
lawyer.
Thanks, man. Thank you.
All right, so let's talk. How did you get into writing?
I had a really weird background in writing, which was that I went to grad school for physics. You remember that? How stupid that was? Like, what
you went
a waste
to grad
of...
school for physics?
I swear
physics
to God.
Physics and astrophysics.
Where, like, Polytech University
Wesleyan and to Columbia for
wow.
a semester.
Yeah. Jesus.
Hey, do you remember we were just in Baltimore and that DJ said, when I said, oh, Kevin's a lawyer, he passed the bar in two states. And he said, well, they were like New Hampshire and the Wyoming.
Right.
And I chastised him. I said, you just belittled Kevin Heffernan.
No, I was setting him up. To that's what you do. You set people up to work you, man. Come on.
Oh,
Jesus
I
Christ.
I'm too nice a guy to do that. So.
I know, but Lemmy's not.
Right.
This is my best friend.
My point.
This is my best friend.
Okay, so Columbia Physics one.
I like him more than I like you.
I don't care.
he doesn't like me more, but I am his best friend. So just,
I know.
Just
okay.
Every time you guys are on the road and you're having a great time, it's like,
yeah,
wow,
just remember, where's Bellin?
Just keep in mind that he's thinking, I wish Bellin were here.
Sure.
It's true. I would prefer.
I wish Bellin was here.
I would prefer Andy's company.
Yeah. I know it. That's
just
okay.
Saying, whatever.
I have no illusions.
Now, Kevin.
Come on.
I love you too.
Thanks, man. Thank you.
I love you.
Thank you. You're my favorite of the lizards.
Thanks, man. Thank you.
He prefers you to me.
That's good.
How does that make you feel?
Well, just I'm more mysterious to him than you are.
It's true. It's true.
All right, back to Bell. Come on.
Yeah, let's
Go. So I went to grad school for physics and astrophysics and turned into, I actually published papers and shit.
Wow.
I'm not kidding. And I was it turns out, a very mediocre scientist.
Right.
And
does any of that shit still stay in your brain, or can you, or is it gone? Is it all gone?
It's all gone. Okay. And it was, I'm not even sure it was ever there. I mean, it was sort of a dodge.
It was good for bar talk.
Yeah, it was like a pickup line
picking
for girls.
Chicks.
Yeah.
I'm a rocket scientist.
I'm a double, physics and astrophysics.
Yeah, okay. Actually, I am a rocket scientist.
Right, I am a rocket scientist. You know,
actually, yeah, and my dad still says, my father loved saying that so much.
My son, the rocket scientist.
My son is a rocket scientist. Okay. That when I quit and people would say, like, what's Andy doing? It wouldn't be like, oh, he's writing for Esquire or whatever. He'd say, my son is a failed astrophysicist. That's what he would say.
Okay. All right.
That's Howie.
That's Howie for you.
All right. So you dropped out to write then?
Left grad school, yes. Okay. I dropped out of many prestigious universities. Sure. And then I ended up working for a company called Global Green, which was this environmental startup company that worked at the UN. So I was working at the UN for a bit, and they actually had me do some writing. And I'm desperately, and this Lemmy can make fun of me about this, I'm desperately dyslexic.
Really? Okay.
So much so that I cannot learn another language. I can barely read and write. I mean, it's embarrassing.
Really?
Yeah.
The irony is that he physically can't write either.
Tell me you have something.
I'll post a photo of this on our Facebook page, but this is Andy Bellin's signing of my yearbook.
All this?
From our,
okay, I'm not going to read all that. But
no,
okay.
You don't have to, although I did want to just read a little excerpt from this.
Oh, great.
He said,
this should only be moderately embarrassing.
You are my best friend.
Aww.
To a lot of people, you are just a cute, talented, funny Chicano.
Nice.
That was good.
But to me, you are a lot more.
What a nice guy.
That's nice. Isn't that nice? Is it all the letters backwards and everything?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
I mean, look at that.
Look at that penmanship. It's terrible.
By the way, that would be, if today I would be happy if my handwriting looked like that.
How does it manifest itself in your writing? I mean, is it?
Well, I was lucky enough to go to the Dalton School in New York City.
Sure.
And they took great care in sort of tutoring me. And I ended up sort of becoming proficient. And what was amazing was that I started writing the stuff at the UN. And it was really like I had a latent skill, like I was James Bond's son, and all of a sudden I knew how to plant bugs somewhere or something. It was like, right. I've always had the skill. And I started writing and really enjoying it, and I asked a bunch of friends who were writers or editors in the literary scene, what do I do if I want to pursue this? And they said, immerse yourself in it. And I literally applied for a job at a literary magazine, and this is a guy with a physics degree. I've not taken an English class since 1984. And I went to the interview at the Paris Review in New York City, which was at the time the most sort of vaulted literary magazine in the world, run by George Plimpton.
Yep.
And I went and I interviewed with George, and I conned him. I said, the future of your magazine, Mr. Plimpton, is the internet. And he went, good God, man, Bellin, you're hired. And he hired me on the spot.
Right.
And of course, I knew nothing about the internet. So I hired somebody with what they paid me to do my job.
Okay.
And I just kind of hung out there, and George took a liking to me because I could drink scotch and I knew pretty girls and I played tennis. And he just kind of kept me around, and I was originally his assistant, but I was a wildly inefficient assistant.
I remember he came to one of your birthday parties and just sat there with a glass of whiskey, just looking around at all the tales.
He was at all the parties. He was such a great guy, and he couldn't fire anybody, so once you proved incompetent, he promoted you.
Okay.
So I was his assistant, and it was for When We Were Kings. Did you guys ever see that documentary?
Best movie ever.
Okay, so I booked him for that. And of course, with my dyslexia and the fact that I'm lazy and stupid, I booked him the wrong thing. And he's like, you know, he came back drunk as a monkey. Like 6 hours later, he's like, Bellin, you sent me to this thing 4 hours early. I was like, oh, shit. And he's like, you're lucky I found a peep show. I was like, okay, well, at least that worked out.
Did you ever write anything for the...
Well, the review, you didn't write. You just edited. The review was a collection of short stories, interviews, and poetry. So you weren't really writing. I wrote some author introductions. I wrote the Woody Allen introduction and Ted Hughes introduction, things like that.
Yeah.
But what George did was that when he took a liking to you, he sort of mentored you. And he said, you know, I really want you to try and write because you have this what he used to say, an entertaining way about you,
okay.
Which meant that I was funny when I was drunk.
Okay.
And I started writing fiction, and George pulled me aside, and he was like, "Bannon, you're terrible. This is awful."
Right.
And he said, "You know, try writing about yourself, because right. you're usually funny when you tell a story." And I did, and he was like, "This is it, man. This is it. Bloody well done." Yeah. And he helped me publish a bunch of stuff about me.
Okay.
And then in his vein, you know, George was famous for playing 14 different professional sports, and what he did was
sure.
he immersed himself in the topic. He went and played professional golf or Paper Lion playing quarterback.
Yep,
and,
yeah.
He told me to do that with the stuff I knew, which was poker. So right around the year 2000, Esquire sort of gathered all of its writers and said, what did you always want to do before the turn of the century? And some guy was like, I want to get in a bar fight. Another guy's like, I want to fuck a model.
Right.
And I was like, I wanted to play in the most mobbed up poker game in New York City, this legendary game downtown. And I was a very good poker player.
Go on.
It was scary. A dog came in here. It's a very nice dog.
Yeah.
It's a cute one. So I went and played in the poker game, and I wrote about it.
They set you up in that game, or what
happened?
Yeah,
it was a $10,000 buy-in, and I went and played. And
Esquire gave you 10 grand.
And you know, they were like, these are pretty serious guys. You should,
what kind of
where,
people, are
where
these
was
like,
it?
It was at a club called the Mayfair, and it was this old New York City card club that had been around forever.
And it was a legal game, or was it a legal game? Illegal
well,
or illegal?
That's always been a gray area.
Okay.
You're allowed to play poker, but you're not allowed to. It's yeah. called the promotion of gambling. You're not yeah. allowed to be a third party taking money off the table.
Right.
So, you know, it was illegal. They were running an illegal card club.
Okay.
But you know,
and what kind of people are they? Are these like not the people you see on the World Series
no,
of Poker on ESPN? These are hardcore.
This was back when you know when poker was people's dirty little secret. This
sure.
was you know before the World Poker Tour.
But are they like businessmen or
yeah,
are
they were,
professional
they
poker
were
players?
Lawyers
are they mob
and,
guys or
yeah, all of the above. And
all
strippers
the above. Okay.
And you know right. bike messengers. And it was a really cool eclectic group of people. It was one of my favorite times in my life.
Okay.
Getting to know all these people. And then I went and I played and I told all the guys, I was like, look, I'm writing about this. I'm going to protect everybody's, and you know, I'm going to protect, change your names.
The fuck you will, kid.
And they were like, yeah, you don't got to do that. I was like, are you serious? Oh yeah, who cares? We're playing poker. So I wrote about it and I got a reputation around sort of the New York literary scene as the guy dumb enough to do anything.
Right.
So they're
okay.
like, we need somebody to eat fire and write about it. Who's dumb enough to do that? It's like, call Andy Bellin. He'll fucking do that.
Yeah.
So there was this legendary Miami pimp named Ron Eppinger.
Okay.
And Ron had sort of run girls in Miami. He was like the Miami Heidi Fleiss for a lot of famous people. And he had, he avoided some FBI sting and was moved back to the Czech Republic with like eight girls named Jana.
Okay.
And started emailing everybody. And he was like, dude, if you guys thought Miami was nuts, the Czech is just off the charts. And Esquire got a hold of the story, and they're like, who's dumb enough to go interview this guy? It's like, Andy Bellin's dumb enough. So Esquire sends me to the Czech Republic. It takes me a couple of days to find the guy. If you've ever been to Czech, it's an old town square. It's a beautiful building, this whorehouse.
Okay.
So I'm sitting in this whorehouse. I don't know what I'm going to do. I can't decide if I'm going to tell the guy I'm a journalist or what I'm doing. And I'm sitting there, and out of one of the rooms with the most beautiful girl I've ever seen in my life walks a dude I know from New York City.
No shit. Really?
And he was sort of a low level, and I guess I could say this now, sort of like a scummy Hollywood producer.
Okay.
And he was like, holy shit, Andy, what are you doing here? And I was like, I know what I'm doing here. What are you doing here? He's like, well, that's a whole other story.
Let's not talk about
it. And I explained what I was doing, and he was like, well, it would be best if I wasn't mentioned, but you know what? To make this not a waste of your time, maybe you can write a script for me.
Okay.
And that's how I sold my first movie.
That's
holy
how
shit.
That's how movies get done
in a
here
whorehouse.
In Hollywood.
In a whorehouse in
and
the Czech Republic.
What was that movie?
It's a movie called A Penny Earned. That actually
I
turned
remember A Penny. No. In fact, Kevin and I remember like there was a moment where we talked about like helping you formulate that pitch.
Probably. I mean,
the main actress was named Penny, right?
Yeah, and it was actually a pretty. It turned into a good script, and it ended up actually being bought and had actresses attached.
Did it get made? Or?
No.
Okay.
But it went through like three iterations, and different people kept auctioning it. Every 5 years, somebody would call and be like, "I'm going to auction that." It's like, okay, sure.
And just as a writer, I mean, like you made some transitions there. You went from writing these articles for Esquire, and then all of a sudden you're writing screenplays. Was that Did you teach yourself how to do that, or did you?
Yeah, how did you do that? You know, Lemmy actually had was sort of ahead of me in that he had. I think you guys had already sold stuff or whatever. So we ended up writing a script together. The first thing I ever wrote, we wrote together and actually got like some buzz, but never sold.
It made it to the final step.
Oh, I remember that.
DNA Inc. It actually made it to Fox, to Peter Rice,
and that was the first. And he sort of taught me how to write scripts.
And did you, was there one that you prefer? Did you prefer the Esquire stuff? Did you prefer the script writing?
You know, I miss having, and it was funny because when I went back and started writing about, when I wrote something for the New York Observer, I really enjoyed writing it again. Had I known, I'm really happy with my career, so I'm thrilled to be where I am. But yeah, I'm gonna always write other stuff too. I mean, I'm working on a book proposal now. I'm also six years late on a book, HarperCollins.
Right.
But I've enjoyed the whole process. So, and I think I'm.
So, but you predominantly write scripts more now.
I do. That's my job. Yeah, that's my job.
But you've had interesting stuff. Like I always loved the story about your grandmother.
Yeah, that my grandmother who
and this
was
is an article that you wrote for.
No, this was actually it turned into a movie. But my grandmother, who was one of the great storytellers of all time, Countess Alicia Pavlovsky, she was just the most charming and offensive and wonderful woman I'd ever met in my life. And you'd be like, "Hey, Grandma, I'm writing a book on poker," and she'd be like, "Oh, you know, it was a terrible poker cheat. You know, steal my money, Nixon." And you're like, fuck you. You didn't play poker with Nixon. And she, you know, some of the time was true. And there were these sort of nostalgic yarns that she used to spin about my family. And I have a sort of wonderfully strange history in my family, and that she used to say that my great-grandfather taught Helen Keller to read.
Okay.
And I was like, no, I've seen the movie. I know who did that.
Yeah.
And then I ended up inheriting my great-grandfather's library, and there's all these beautiful leather-bound books, and out of one of the books falls this letter from Helen Keller.
Okay.
And it's written to my great-grandmother on the day that my great-grandfather died, and just sort of professing her love for him. Uh-huh. And I was like, holy shit, like, what is this?
Wow.
And it turns out that he sponsored a bunch of her education. He paid for it.
Okay.
Now, of course, my grandmother had to, you know.
Yeah, she turned it into
ABC, you know, like on in the stick in the mud or whatever it was.
And it turns out I actually wrote those letters. No, I've seen that one letter.
Framed. So my grandmother used to always say that she was a race car driver. And, you know, when I was a kid, I wanted to be center fielder for the Yankees. And, you know.
Was she a race car driver?
It turns out she was.
Okay.
And it's amazing.
When she passed away, I was mysteriously willed the contents of the basement of her. It was basically a garage in Rome. We had a house in Rome.
Yeah.
And this, I didn't think much of it. And then a couple of months later, this giant shipping container shows up at my house in L.A.
Yeah.
And out rolls a 1954 light blue, baby blue Porsche First Series Carrera.
Holy shit.
And it has not only in it the still red African clay, but in the bonnet, and that's the front of the car
there
without an engine, as we like to say.
Sure.
In your circles.
Yeah.
In
the effete snob circles that I run in.
I'm with it.
There was this briefcase, and in the briefcase were the pictures from the greatest race I'd ever seen, which was something called the Rallye Le Cap, which was started in Algiers, finished in Cape Town 3 weeks later, and in 1956, whatever it was, they literally drove across Africa.
Right.
This is before highways. They were driving across deserts with oil cans as sort of mile markers and shit.
Right.
And it was a race of, you know, a woman in a Porsche and a guy in a Ferrari and a guy
what
in
year
an
would
Alpha.
This have been?
This is 56.
Okay.
And it's all the pictures of it. And I swear to God, they'd gotten to places in sort of the Belgian Congo that, like, had never seen white people. It was. So I called my...
But didn't Porsche sponsor your grandma?
We're still trying to find... They were the only female team. And my grandmother said Porsche sponsored, and we're still trying to figure that out, especially since she got the car in Italy. So it's kind
of
looking
like... Does it function,
like
the car, still? Or?
Well, here, there's a... That's a whole other story. We'll get back to
that. Okay, yeah, we'll just tease it a little bit.
So I took the case and I went over to an old friend of ours named Nick Stein, who I was represented at Broder at the Bob Broder's company,
one of the
greatest men on earth. And I took it over to Nick Stein, who's Cameron Diaz's agent. And I said, I know Cammy likes cars and stuff, and I showed him the stuff, and I had this great pitch of my grandmother's race across Africa, and I went and pitched Cammy, and she hopped on board, and we went and sold it to Fox for a ton of money. And it was this great script, and it's actually, I mean, I go back and read it, and it's a pretty terrible script, but
it's an early script that you, I mean, in terms
I wrote it in 2005.
Gotcha.
Before I'd read it today, it's just,
it'd be different.
By the way, that is, when we go back and look at DNA Inc., the script that we wrote together.
It hurts to watch.
Like, it's, at the time, we were like, it's a brilliant script. You go back now, and it reads like Tango and Cash. Like,
it's
with our characters quipping at each other.
And, oh, man, it's
That's
so
the fun
painful.
Thing about it.
It is the fun thing.
So they didn't make that movie. They didn't make the Cameron Diaz movie.
They didn't, and every once in a while, somebody reads it and is like, holy shit, we got to go get this thing out, and it's got like a couple of million dollars.
Amanda Seyfried in it, bro.
I just sent it to her agent who hasn't called me back.
There you go.
By the way, I would like to say, so Andy and Nick Stein and Cameron Diaz were at a Yankees game, and they were sitting in Alex Rodriguez's box a year or two ago.
Okay.
And Andy texts me a picture of Nick Stein flipping me the bird.
Okay.
Says, Nick Stein says, fuck you.
This is like an amalgam of stories, but yeah, I mean, all of this is true just at different times so far, but yeah.
Yeah, and so I, what did I... What was my response to that?
Oh, that was the best thing ever that you ever did in your life.
Yes.
Within like 7 seconds, Lemmy texts back a picture of his dick on the yearbook page of Nick Stein's sister, basically his dick on Kathy's...
Oh, that's excellent. And how did Nick Stein really respond to that?
You'll never be at CAA, pal.
Talk yourself out of a career.
Yeah.
Enjoy your boutique agency.
Yeah, you'll never work in this town again.
Yeah. But he laughed as that. I mean, it was just the immediacy, and it was just it was a perfect response. It was an immediate response, and it was definitive. It was like, that's it. There's not. Nick was like, and but you. I mean, there was nothing we could do. It was just
over.
Perfect. It was game, set, match right there.
Yeah, it was good. It was good. Okay. Yeah.
I want to talk a little about the poker book.
Let me button this thing, which was that. So the car that. My grandmother's car sat in my driveway in LA for about a year, and you could see about half of the car from the street.
Okay.
And one day I'm playing golf, and my girlfriend at the time called me and was like, there's somebody at the door. I was like, well, answer it. She's like, I did. Mm-hmm. I was like, well, what's the problem? It's like, it's Jerry Seinfeld. And I was like, okay, what does he want? And she was like, he wants to buy your car. I was like, he doesn't know what it is from the street. She was like, no, he says he knows what it is. Uh-huh. And Jerry has an encyclopedic knowledge of Porsches.
Cars,
not even cars, just Porsches. Porsche, he knows every Porsche ever.
Didn't he build a garage for his Porsches in New York?
That's the wives' tale. I don't know him very well.
Okay.
But... So then I sort of got on the phone with him, and he was like,
oh, hey, Jerry.
I think it kind of went like that. I probably called him Mr. Seinfeld. Yeah. But,
hello, Mr. Seinfeld.
And he was like, I want to buy your car. And I was like, it's not for sale. It's my family's history. And then he made his offer, and I was like, sold! And I sold it right there on the spot.
So he owns it now.
He owns it. He's put... probably close to $1 million into restoring it. And
it's a beautiful car.
It's taken 6 years.
And have you seen it since that he
I have
does
not,
work?
I've seen, I've seen pictures.
Okay,
I have,
pictures,
not,
yeah.
have not seen it.
Does he restore the cars himself, or does he hire
he's got a guy.
He's
got a guy.
He's got guys.
He's got a guy.
But if not for his largesse, there would be...
I mean that's awesome, man.
Yeah, he's awesome.
You could... Hey, can I... Sit in it once in a while.
Yeah, I have too much class to do that. But maybe you
it's
should.
Your grandmother's car. I don't care about it. It's your grandmother's car.
I'll run into him somewhere and say something.
But before we talk about the book, I want to quickly talk about you're writing now. You're pitching a movie with a writer named Eric Roth.
Yes.
Who just to give a quick rundown?
Greatest
on him,
American screenwriter ever.
Yeah, he wrote Suspect with Cher and Liam Neeson, Forrest Gump, Horse Whisperer, The Insider, Ali, Munich, The Good Shepherd, The Curious Case of Benjamin Button. Extremely loud and incredibly close.
Wow.
And a thousand other things.
How do you hook up with a guy like that?
Through friends.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, I got friends.
I
got some friends.
You know, they had an open project, and he's producing it. He doesn't want to write it, and he met with a bunch of writers, and, you know, sort of took a shine.
And now he is going to write it with you, or no?
I'm going to write it, and he's going to oversee it.
That's a good guy to oversee.
But so you guys are pitching this idea around. I love the idea, but we shouldn't talk about it, obviously, because you don't want to give out your ideas.
Yeah.
But, you know, you and I started talking about, I asked you, like, about pitching versus spec writing.
Okay, yeah.
So like, for a spec script in Hollywood is when you actually just write a script for free without meeting with somebody, and then you try to sell the entire script. A pitch.
Now, the gamble on that is that you put all this work into it, and they don't sell it. That's the downside.
Yeah.
And then a pitch is that is when you put together an idea for a movie without actually writing the script, and you go around to the studios and you say, this is my idea, this is how the story will unfold, do you want to pay me to write the script so I don't have to do that work?
Right, and here's the main
character.
Those
are the two ways to go, and there are ups and upsides and downsides to both those directions to go.
I don't, unless it's TV, I pitch TV and have a great track record of selling TV and just not having it ever get made.
Hey, so do we.
Yeah. I mean, I've never had a frame shot. They've spent millions of dollars on me writing stuff.
Sure.
It's ridiculous.
It's the beauty of the business.
Yeah, I feel terrible. I mean, I feel terrible about it. I don't. Anyway, so. But
not your fault, man.
Well, at times I feel like it is. So I try not to pitch movies anymore unless, like with Eric, you know, you're going around with Eric and it's a big deal and everybody, you know, comes down to meet him. And
you want to meet that guy.
He's the greatest American screenwriter ever.
Yeah.
So it has been a really unique pleasure. But I've gotten to a point in my career where I had an idea that I had about a 2-month period between landing the job with Eric and then when we were going to pitch, because he's so busy, he's writing Cleopatra and it's just, you know, and the guy's doing everything.
Yeah.
And I had 2 months to kill, and I was thinking I was going to pitch something, and I thought, wow, in 2 months, instead of wasting 2 months on a pitch that'll probably not sell, why don't I just write a script?
Yeah.
And it took me less time to write the script than it was to create the pitch. I mean, I don't know how much you guys...
No, that's always the case. I mean, you end up spending a lot of time putting a pitch together just because you don't want to miss your opportunity, and then... You realize maybe I could have written it.
Well, then because you start to give, you practice your pitch on your agents and managers, and they say, you know what's missing from this thing? Uh-huh. You could really use a better nemesis, or really a better driving force, or a better engine. And so you're like, oh, God, I don't want to think of this goddamn thing. And so you start just trying to come up with these random plot points.
Yeah.
Whereas when you're writing a script, when you just outline the script to write it, whether it's on note cards or on a piece of paper,
you're working that shit out anyway.
And you're finding out where your holes are, and you're like, okay, I could use something like this. And so you're spending the time doing the same thing
and
much
more.
And
so that's the conclusion that you came to.
Yeah, and I ended up writing a script, and it is, you know, I think that there's a definitive moment in a screenwriter's career. I think a lot of early screenwriters, when you're first selling stuff and you sell your first script and you're like, I can't wait to see this on, you know, the screen, and it's not going to get made. It's so hard to get stuff.
Yeah.
You don't know that at the time. I used to write the script. I was writing a script, and I was like, this is the one.
this is it, baby.
The script.
Right.
And then at a certain point, I sort of became a professional, and I'm a, you know, hired gun, and I rewrite stuff. And then I stopped writing the script, and I just started writing scripts, and it was my job, and I got good at it, and some of it's really good, and some of it sucks, and I'm, you know, embarrassed to read it. And then I ended up sitting down and writing this script in 6 weeks.
Okay.
That is the best thing I've ever written in my life, because
this is the Eric Roth script? No, this is a different thing. Okay, gotcha.
I don't want to talk about the plot, but it's old school and badass and moves, and it's kinetic, and it's exciting, and it's dramatic.
It's good.
Okay.
It's so good, and it's because A, I had no pressure, B, I had all the time in the world, and C, it was an exercise in proving to myself that this is something that I enjoy.
Yeah.
That I'm no longer doing this for money. I'm doing this for me, and hopefully it'll sell. And then I think the release of the pressure, and that it was no longer like, I think every writer sees every assignment as some crucible that if you fail, it just destroys your self-worth. That I just enjoyed it to such an extent that it really, friends of mine who read it was like, I can hear in the characters how much you enjoyed writing them.
Yeah.
And as I'm describing this to my wife, she starts laughing at me, and she's like, what? I was like, what? And she's like, you sound like you wrote the script.
I was like, I did.
It's the script. And it's pretty badass. Let me read it.
So. Yeah, I did. Okay, and the other thing I also want to talk about is Giuseppe Tornatore.
Yes.
The director of one of my favorite movies of all time, Cinema Paradiso, or Cinema Paradiso.
Si.
How was that? I mean, this is a real, like, European filmmaker.
So wait, what's the deal? You wrote a script for him?
I'm rewriting a script that Giuseppe has spent, like, 9 years writing.
Oh, wow. Okay.
About the Siege of Leningrad. And I love Giuseppe, and he's, you know, in a weird way. I mean, Eric Roth is an icon, but he's a human being. Like, you know, I can sit and talk with him. Giuseppe, because there's sort of a language barrier and he lives in a different country and he, you know, he was doing
Italian, bro.
I am, but I don't live there. And, you know, he was doing stuff with Sergio Leone and stuff that it was so, intimidating to deal with him. And then they hand me a 200-page script that is the most dour, depressing thing ever. And they're like, make it funny. And I was like, what? And they was like, just, you know, pick it up a little, you know, a little laugh here and there. I was like,
punch it up for us.
It's the Siege of Leningrad. It's 900 days of starvation. Like, right. People are eating each other. It's like, make it funny.
Yeah.
It's like Life is Beautiful.
It is so sad. And Giuseppe is such an amazing writer that it's heartbreaking. Every page is heartbreaking. And also they're like, okay, it's a 200-page script. They're like, I don't know, something in the 130s. So yeah. I'm sitting with Giuseppe.
Ballpark.
I'm sitting with Giuseppe, and everything I cut, he goes, Andy, why you cut that scene? It's so strong. Every scene, Andy's so strong. Why you cut that scene? I got to cut fucking 90 pages.
Right.
Everything. And he's watching me because...
So you're doing this in front of him?
Yeah, he's old school. Okay, he's old school. I am a galley slave. Sure. I am nothing. I am a piece of shit to this man. I am just there to piss on his art.
Right.
Okay? So literally, I'll sort of like turn the page, and he'll be really happy that I didn't touch that page. He'll go like, nice. It's very nice. And then like I'll reach for the pen, and he'll go like, oh. Oh.
Why don't you read it with him not around?
Because it's his script. What am I going to do? Like go into the closet?
It's like watching a movie with someone who made it. You
know? No, but this is great because Andy's telling me about, you know, he's pitching with Eric Roth.
Yeah.
And how, you know, I was like, and who does the pitching in that thing? He's like, well, you know, Eric Roth is like, you know, I don't really like pitching. Why don't you just do all the talking? So he's with this giant heavy hitter.
Right.
And Eric's sort of sitting in the background going like, And today he actually was like, you know, I don't. We were using that analogy. I don't think that's going to work anymore. I was like, we're in the pitch, Eric. And he just kind of changed directions, and it was awesome.
Yeah.
And everybody was just hanging on everywhere. I was like, and there you go. Yeah. There's Eric.
Mr. Eric.
But this is the thing. Like, you know, 30 years from now, when you're like, you know, you've written everything under the sun.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, some little...
There's some... fucking snot nosed
writer.
Little kid from the Paris Review comes in who, you know, he's like, yeah, you got the job to rewrite you, pal. You're going to pull all the same shit.
Absolutely.
Okay. If I have like 1/3 of Giuseppe's career and 1/18 of Eric Roth's career, I'll be happy with that. So
fair enough. All right. Let's talk to poker. Talk poker.
Yeah, you want
to
talk poker?
Sure.
Just let's, you know, hit that book. Is that book, right?
Poker Nation.
What year?
Poker Nation.
2002.
And it grew out of writing that Esquire stuff?
Yeah. So I wrote that Esquire article and then.
Let me ask you a question. Are you prior to that, were you a great poker player or a lover of poker, or what is your thing?
Yes, I was a student of the game. Okay. In grad school, a lot of the mathematicians would play backgammon poker because they felt like they had a statistical advantage, which was true sort of in stud. And then as soon as Texas Hold'em took shape, it was, if you can count to 48, you're as good as everybody else. So.
Sure, okay.
But it's interesting, though, because I remember one time you entered me into an online poker game.
Did I?
Yeah, and you said you were like, here, I'm just going to teach you some of the nuances, because you know it's like you watch the professionals and then there are, you know, all the tells and all that stuff that. We're playing the game and I'm like about to make a bet. He's like, no, you don't want to do that, because here's what's going to happen. This person clearly has this thing. This person over here, this bitch got it. She got this thing. This one's, he's definitely got an ace nine. I'm telling you, that's an ace nine. I was like, what the fuck? How do you know all that? He's like, look at the way they're betting. This person's doing this, and sure enough, it's like he's like, don't do that bet. Don't do that bet. Yeah. I did the bet.
Yeah.
And sure enough, everything he said, including the ace nine, came up. I was like, how in the fuck do you know that?
And do you know just from playing that much? Or from...
Well, in that case, we had Anderson Cooper in the other room. And
Okay.
You see what I did there?
Yeah, that's nice. Callback. Yeah,
but interestingly, okay, so in the book, Poker Nation. See,
this is actually, this is great.
I have an issue.
Okay.
In the chapter on tells.
Okay. So this book, Poker Nation, by Andy Bellin.
HarperCollins
2002.
Available on Amazon.com.
Go get it. Yeah. Amazon.com.
An excellent book. As I was in Barnes & Noble one time and like...
It was in the window. This book was a big deal. Yeah.
But it's about you in a tournament or just the nature of playing poker?
This is not like if you want to become a better poker player, this is not like... This doesn't teach you how to play Ace King under the gun or anything like that. This is narrative nonfiction. It's anecdotal. It's about my experiences playing poker, but other people's experience playing poker. And also sort of it's... an insightful look into the life of a poker player, and also my unique take on it, sort of being a rich Upper East Side prep school brat, sort of mixing
a lot of poker. And,
All right, what do you got? There's a chapter in there with Steve Lemmy in it?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. And it's the chapter on Tells.
Okay.
And I take an exception for this, but I do want to plug the book a little bit. So here's the little prelude to this chapter. It's a saying here. A guy walks into a bar and it's a joke. A guy walks into a bar and notices three men and a dog playing poker. The dog is playing beautifully. "That's a very smart dog," the man says. "Not really," says one of the players. "Every time he gets a good hand, he wags his tail." That's a tell.
Okay. Gotcha.
So, this is the way this chapter starts out, and this is what I take issue with.
Okay.
Umbrage.
My close friend Steve and I spent the last week of August 1984 up in the Adirondack Mountains at my grandmother's place. Even at an awkward 16, Steve had a fantastic gift for finding women to date, no matter where he was. He had a girlfriend at the time, to whom he was supposed to be faithful, but for as long as I've known him, that sort of nominal monogamous commitment has been inconsequential.
Bing, bing, bing. That's your wife reading that freaking chapter.
Literally, his wife just texted him.
Yeah, I hear that shit. On this summer trip, he managed to conjure up a female companion out of the limited population of Paul Smith, New York, and proceeded to spend most of his six-day vacation with her. The night we got home, Steve and I met some friends at a restaurant, one of them being his girlfriend. He walked up to the table and kissed her passionately. She looked him dead in the eye and said, "I can't believe you cheated on me again." After the obligatory exchange of accusations and denials, Steve finally confessed to his infidelity and groveled for forgiveness.
I can see that.
A few hours later, she accepted his apology. Wasn't high school great? And they went on to another glorious 3 weeks of being together. After receiving absolution that night, Steve asked his girlfriend how she figured out his indiscretion so quickly. "Easy," she said. "First, you didn't look at me while you were walking over to the table. You were staring at the ground the whole time. Second, you kissed me like you were some porn star. And to top it all off, once I accused you of cheating on me, all you did was smile and blink." I looked over at Steve while she was saying this, and sure enough, he was smiling and blinking like crazy. Steve had, as it's known in poker, a tell.
Okay. All right. And what? That sounds cool. Why did he take every issue
the
with that?
The entire story is fucking bullshit. That's
I bet there's... It sounds to me like there's a lot of truth.
There's a lot of truth to it.
There's a lot of truth in that.
Yeah.
Yeah. On the next page, by the way, I appear as a different Rube in the story as Tom Lemmy. Okay. So he just split my name off.
No, that's
the two.
Okay. The guy's got it right. You know what I mean? Come on.
I will say that the best thing about that is that when the book started sort of building up sort of reputation and publicity, the Atlantic Monthly, which is my favorite magazine, excerpted a part of the book, and they excerpted
that one,
that chapter.
Awesome.
So it was only read by like millions of people.
And did you, is that book detail you playing in these high profile tournaments?
No, this
or
was pre LA, okay. And most of the, you know, this helped light the poker boom fuse a little bit. Yeah. This book, a wonderful book by a guy named Jim McManus called Positively Fifth Street. And then the World Poker Tour suddenly getting on TV
and then
you can see people's hold cards and hole cards. And, you know, there was always a right decision or wrong decision. It just became immensely popular, and it overtook what were the sort of cigar clubs and golf games.
Sure.
And it became how guys were spending their afternoons and evenings.
Yeah.
And then when I showed up in L.A. and I was trying to sell my stuff, there was a young group of Hollywood guys who were sort of learning the game, and I sort of
stole their money.
No, yeah, I made some money, but the truth is that two of these guys are like the best players. Two of these guys are top 20 players in the world.
Oh, okay, and these are famous.
I think
guys
one or two of them
discuss.
Have gone to the World Series of Poker.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean anything. Like, two of these guys. One of these guys may be the most profitable poker player in history.
And would we know that guy if you told us his name?
Maybe, but I'm not going to tell you his name.
No, you don't have to. I'm saying, but we know the guy.
But now, like, inside the poker world, what is the feeling? Because before these days, like, all right, for instance, the World Series of Poker, I mean, yes, you had to beat a ton of players. But now, I mean, you have to beat, what, like, 1,000 times
now,
more players.
Now there's so much. I mean, back in the old day when there were 100 guys playing in the World Series, it was a real test of skill. But nowadays, there are so many people and there's so much time devoted to playing in a specific tournament that to win the tournament, you have to make a terrible decision, say, I've got the better hand, and find out you don't. You have to be a 10-1 underdog 10 times and win. So you have to get lucky so many times to actually just be considered at the end, at the final table, that it's just... It's not quite the test of skill.
But don't you usually see a lot of the same guys in that?
Not really. No? I mean, no. Right. If you look at the final table, it's usually one pro, and it's like, oh, I know that guy. It's like, yeah, you do. But the 800 other pros got knocked out.
Yeah.
You know, it used to be that it was always Phil Hellmuth or Eric Seidel. Those are the two probably the two greatest poker players ever. And
what about the story I was just reading about Phil Ivey, who was accused by some casino of counting or cheating at Baccarat?
Oh, I didn't know that. But, you know, Phil's a very smart kid, and he looks to exploit casinos' weaknesses.
I don't know who he is. Is he like a big poker player or something?
Yeah, he's an enormous poker player and a fearless kid and a very smart guy.
They call it's actually annoying. They call him the Tiger Woods of poker, and it's only by virtue of the fact that he's black.
Okay. And good-looking. And,
yeah.
And, he's very good friends with with a dear friend of mine named Chris Lorenzo.
Okay.
And, you know, Chris tells me stories that, you know, Phil looks to exploit casinos' weaknesses, and he hates casinos. He hates that they have an advantage, and if he can hurt them, he will. And I think that's a glorious ambition. So,
all right, Belzo.
One final funny Bell and Lemmy story before we walk here.
Let's see. I mean, there's there's the video game fight that we got into.
Oh, okay. I like to hear that.
Which one's
that? This was like, okay. I'll tell the story then.
Okay.
It was back in like '94.
Yeah.
We'd just gotten out of school, and it was like Sega NHL Hockey had been released. One of the greatest video games ever.
Maybe the greatest.
Mm-hmm. And Andy and I, we lived on West 86th Street,
right?
Just a block away from each
we
other.
We would stay up. I have the best story
on West
about
86th Street.
We would stay up all night drinking and smoking. Smoking cigarettes.
Cigarettes, listening to like the Soundgarden Super Unknown album, listening to Red Hot Chili Peppers.
Yeah,
and playing video games.
Playing this hockey game, which was great because you could actually save all the statistics, and you could play a full season, and we would each play. We weren't allowed to play with the Rangers because we're both Rangers fans, so I'd play with the Red Wings. He would play with the Blackhawks.
Okay.
Somebody else, another friend of ours, played with the Pittsburgh Penguins.
Okay.
And we would just play nonstop till the sun came up every single night.
Then what happened?
Then what happened is I got a girlfriend, and so like I stopped showing up to play the games.
Okay.
And Andy started getting really mad at me.
Okay.
And then finally he said, you know, one time I'm going to invite you to play hockey, and then I'm just going to stop inviting you. Mm-hmm. And then I heard he was having a party, and he didn't invite me.
That's true.
And then I went over to Andy's house, and he was like, oh, I didn't realize you were going to be here. Only my real friends showed up.
Really?
Or something like that.
God, this is awful.
And then we didn't speak for 6 months.
Is that true?
It
That's
is true.
Humiliating.
A hockey game, over a video game.
Well, yeah.
The best one was that I was working at the UN at the time, and there was some night that we were up all night just getting hammered. And then I got a phone call. They were like, hey, you need you to come into work. It was like 6 in the morning. I was drunk, hadn't slept. I was like, sure, I'll come in. And I had lied on my resume that I was fluent in French. And I have like 87 words of French, and none of them are appropriate for a mixed conversation.
Yeah.
And they were literally like, we need you to sit in. The translator's sick. We need you to translate and transcribe what this, you know, like, I don't know who it was, like Mitterrand is saying or something.
Sure.
And I literally had to stand there for 4 hours sitting there with the headphones on, pretending that I was transcribing what he was saying.
He started a war.
You know, that some like poor refugee didn't get his. And then the next day they were like, where are the notes? And I said, I left my bag on the subway. And my boss, who had smelled booze and saw me falling.
That's your tell.
Yeah. Was like, are you going to stick with that? I was like, yeah, that's my story. I'm sticking to it. And then I was fired shortly after.
Yeah. I remember I had a very uncomfortable situation at Andy's wedding. Not Andy's wedding. At Andy's brother's wedding. Uh-huh. Andy pointed out a guy, and he was like, see that dude over there? He played, was it World of Warcraft? There was the first like real serious giant role-playing game.
I played a ton of Warcraft, but
I wish I could remember the name of the game. But like he said, this guy played that game so hard, 24/7, that eventually he just sort of passed out and woke up in the hospital a few days later. He had been in a coma for like three
days.
He had
a seizure.
And I went up to him, and I was like, that's so cool. And I went up to him at the wedding, and I was like, dude, I just hear like you fucking played this video game so hard that you woke up in the hospital 3 days later. And he's like, this isn't fucking funny, man. I lost my wife. She walked out with the kids. I lost my job. Fuck you, motherfucker.
Oh, Jesus.
And walked away from me. And I was like,
and that guy was?
I will not say his name, but you know, Lemmy was Mr. Video Game Guy. He's sure. Joystick.
I was Joystick.
Sure. So yeah. Even when he was good like, yeah, but that guy lost his family. That's awesome. That's how much video
way
game
to
he
go.
Can play.
Yeah. That's true.
And that
true.
Guy was Anderson Cooper.
And that guy.
Boom. Bringing it around.
Let's wrap it up on that.
All right. Let's chew it. All right. Let's do a little chewing. Thanks, Bellin, for joining us, man. That was fun. I hope you had a good time.
I did. It was very nice to see you guys.
Good luck with Lovelace.
Thanks so much. August 9th. August 9th. Everywhere. Get out there. VOD.
Lovelace.
Everyone
August
go
9th.
See it.
Go see it.
Yeah.
Get Poker Nation, too.
Poker True. Nation. Great book.
Yeah. So everybody seems to like it.
Yeah. It's good.
And deliver your next book. Jesus Christ.
Oh, my God. Yeah. You and my editor both. Yeah. I'll get on it.
Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, guys.
Bye, guys.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.